You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
Well, this is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the May 8th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes to you the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. Last Wednesday, a British judge sentenced WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, to 50 weeks in prison for jumping bail when he took refuge in the Ecuador embassy in London 7 years ago for a crime that allegedly took place in Sweden, for which he was never charged nor his extradition demanded. His legal troubles, of course, are far from over. The U.S. is seeking his extradition for prosecution in that courtroom, accusing him of having conspired with then-Private Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, to hack into a Pentagon computer network and trying to help Manning illegally download more classified information than Manning had originally furnished WikiLeaks. That original cache of more than 2 million diplomatic cables and documents exposed secret communications about the U.S. wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and from U.S. embassies throughout the globe that cast a harsh and unforgiving light on the U.S. role in both wars, as well as Washington's efforts to undermine and destabilize the governments of Syria and Venezuela going back well more than a decade. Assange, now 47, was arrested on April 11th after the Ecuadorian president, Lenin Moreno, withdrew his government's protection of him and allowed the police to take him out of the embassy, drag him out in London, where he had lived since 2012. The same day he appeared in court and was convicted on the charge of skipping bail. Meanwhile, Chelsea Manning, who served 7 years of a 35-year sentence in federal prison for her role in releasing the documents to WikiLeaks, and who has been in jail for the past 2 months for refusing to testify against Assange before a Virginia grand jury, formally asked a court to release her from jail on Monday, saying, quote, "Nothing will convince me to testify," unquote. By an amazing coincidence, Assange's eviction from the Ecuadorian embassy came a few weeks after Ecuador had received a $4.2 billion loan from the U.S.-dominated International Monetary Fund. The domestic response to Assange's eviction and arrest for his extraordinary journalistic achievement has been fairly critical of the Australian gadfly by some who are known here as champions of a free press, including writers for those papers that originally profited from them and his gigantic cache of U.S. diplomatic cables and documents. In an op-ed in the New York Times on April 27th, Professor Edward Wasserman, a professor of journalism and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, notes Assange's complex and complicated history, but points out that the persecution reflects a serious problem that extends beyond him as a single individual, end quote. News is in danger, Wasserman writes, and news isn't a person. It's a process which desperately needs protecting. The element of that process that is most in peril is a source, says Wasserman, and for all his sins, real and alleged, Julian Assange has been one of the most extraordinary sources of the new millennium, end quote. Those are the words and opinion of UC Berkeley Professor Ed Wasserman, who will be my guest on the program at 20 minutes past the hour, when we'll discuss the impact of Julian Assange and the current dangers to those who blow the whistle on government deceptions and falsehoods. Well, on the subject of Julian Assange, I've been disturbed that the media found dissecting his personality more important than actually examining the contents of what WikiLeaks disclosed, which upend what you and I have been reading and hearing on the mainstream media, particularly about Venezuela. What you will find there are cables by U.S. officials that describe how going back to the early days of Hugo Chavez and working through the Republican and Democrat Party branches of the National Endowment for Democracy, how the State Department helped create an opposition, first against Chavez and then against Maduro, through generous payoffs and propaganda, which I suspect the Venezuelan Constitution would have something to say about. A Puerto Rican friend of who has read the Venezuelan Constitution in the original Spanish writes that it is very clear that the conditions for removing President Maduro from office have not been met, and even if they had, the vice president would be in line to be named as interim president and not a U.S. puppet like Juan Guaido. you were following the news last week, you couldn't have missed reports of the latest clashes between Israel and the Palestinian residents of Gaza, against whom Israel has launched three wars in the past decade and who have they have suppressed under a brutal siege since 2007. 2 million Gazans, because of that siege, have been forced to live in what foreign officials and journalists have described as, quote, the world's largest outdoor prison, and what the UN has repeatedly called a humanitarian disaster. With Egypt obeying Israeli and U.S. diktats and keeping its southern border closed as well, and Israel carefully guarding Gaza's Mediterranean coast shoreline, there are literally no avenues of escape from that prison. No matter. Israel not only has an array of nuclear weapons, it has the most powerful army in the Middle East and one of the most deadly air forces in the world, thanks to the generosity of our bought-off Congress and the indifference of U.S. taxpayers. And what Israel has been doing to the people of Gaza these past days is defended to the hilt not only by President Trump, but the leaders of both the House and Senate. I'm not going to describe the details of the most recent engagement, other than to point out that armed resistance by a people under occupation against their occupier is considered legitimate under international law, and that Israel used as an excuse to launch bombing raids on the Strip with U.S.-provided F-16s was the wounding of two Israeli soldiers near the Gaza border. What I'm going to do instead to help you understand the mindset of the Israeli military is read to you from a transcript of an April 21st interview with Brigadier General Zvika Fogel of the Israel Defense Forces on the Yuman Hashuva program on Israel's Khan radio, in which the general defends the killing by Israeli army's snipers of a 14-year-old boy who posed no threat of any kind that preceded the shooting of the Israeli soldiers. "Greetings, Brigadier General Zvika Fogel," says the host, Ron Nissel. "Should the IDF, the Israeli army, rethink its use of snipers?" he asks. "That's the impression that maybe someone lowered the bar for using live fire, and this may be the result." "Ron," General Fogel replies, "let's maybe look at this matter on three levels. At the tactical level that we all love dealing with, the local one, also at the level of values, and with your permission, we'll also rise up to the strategic level." "At the tactical level," goes on the general, "any person who gets close to the fence, anyone who could be a future threat to the border of the State of Israel and its residents, should bear a price for that violation. If this child or anyone else gets close to the fence in order to hide an explosive device or check if there are any dead zones there or to cut the fence so someone could infiltrate the territory of the State of Israel to kill us, then his punishment is death?" asked Ron Nissel. "His punishment is death," says the general. "As far as I'm concerned, then, yes, if you could only shoot to stop him in the leg or arm, great. But if it's more than that, then, yes, you want to check with me whose blood is thicker, ours or theirs. It's clear to you that if one such person will manage to cross the fence or hide an explosive device there, but we were taught that live fire is only used when the soldiers face immediate danger," Nissel responds. "Come, let's move over to the level of values," returns General Fogel, as if talking to a schoolboy. "Assuming that we understand the tactical level, as we cannot tolerate a crossing of our border or a violation of our border, let's proceed to the level of values. I am not Ahmad Tibi," says the general, referring to a leader of Israel's Palestinian community. "I am Zvika Fogel. I know how these orders are given. I know how a sniper does the shooting. I know how many authorizations he needs before he receives an authorization to open fire. It is not the whim of one or the other sniper who identifies a small body of a child now and decides he'll shoot. Someone marks the target for him very well and tells him exactly why one has to shoot and what the threat is from that individual. And to my great sorrow, sometimes when you shoot at a small body and you intended to hit his arm or shoulder, it goes even higher. But if that's the price that we have to pay to preserve the safety and quality of life of the residents of the State of Israel, then that's the price. But now, with your permission, let's go up one level and look at the overview. It's clear to you that Hamas is fighting for consciousness at the moment. It is clear to you and to me. Is it hard for them to do?" asked the interviewer on Nissel. "Aren't we providing them with sufficient ammunition in this battle?" "Oh, we're providing them, but," begins General Fogel. because it does not do all that well for us, those pictures that are distributed around the world, interjects Nestle. Look, Ron, concedes the Israeli general, we're even terrible at it. There's nothing to be done. David always looks better than Goliath. That's entirely, and in this case, we are the Goliath, not the David. That's entirely clear to me. It's clear to us that Hamas can't continue to tolerate the fact that its rockets are not managing to hurt us. Its tunnels are eroding. Yes, agrees Nestle. And doesn't have too many suicide bombers who continue to believe the fairy tale about the virgins waiting up there. It will drag us into a war. I do not want to be on the side that gets dragged. I want to be on the side that initiates things, says the Israeli general. I do not want to wait for the moment where it finds a weak spot and attacks me there. If tomorrow morning it gets into a military base or a kibbutz and kills people there and takes prisoners of war or hostages, call it as you like. We're in a whole new script. I want the leaders of Hamas to wake up tomorrow morning and for the last time in their life see the smiling faces of the IDF. That's what I want to have happen, says the general. But we are dragged along, so we're putting snipers up because we want to preserve the values we were educated by, says General Vogel. We can't always take a single picture and put it before the whole world. We have soldiers there, our children, who were sent out and received very accurate instructions about whom to shoot to protect us. Let's back them up. Brigadier General of Reserve Zvika Vogel, formerly head of the Southern Command Staff, says host Ron Nessiel, thank you for your words. May you only hear good news, General Vogel replies. That was an exchange between Brigadier General Zvika Vogel of the Israel Defense Forces and Israeli radio host Ron Nessiel this past April 21st after an Israeli sniper killed an unarmed 14-year-old boy, Palestinian boy in the Gaza Strip. May you think of that exchange when you read or hear in our media a line that was on the front page of Monday's New York Times that in the recent clashes with Israel said, quote, Palestinians seized every opportunity to wreak havoc. And you may think of that interview when you hear American politicians such as my former congressperson, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, talk about our, quote unquote, shared values with Israel. I wonder in what category she would place Brigadier General Vogel's. Pelosi and those running the Democrat Party have been put on notice that its unconditional support of Israel is heading for the rocks. Move On, the country's largest grassroots advocacy group with millions of members, which called on the Democrat presidential candidates not to attend the AIPAC annual conference in March, announced late last month its first endorsements for the 2020 election. They are Minnesota's Ilhan Omar and Michigan's Rashida Tlaib, the first two Muslim women elected to Congress. Both have openly challenged their party's support of Israel while backing the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement targeting Israel. Move On said in a statement last week, that it has over 16,000 members in Minnesota's 5th District and that 77% of them backed the Somalia-born Omar, while Palestinian-American Tlaib received the backing of 88% of the 7,000 Move On members in Michigan's 13th District. What does it tell you about who controls our media when you can only find this highly significant story in the Israeli and American Jewish press? Finally, you've heard that the U.S. Navy is sending the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, along with a bomber squadron, toward the waters off Iran, the Persian Gulf, thanks to the efforts of National Security Advisor and his Israel devotee, John Bolton, who, I should remind you, was appointed to replace retired General H.R. McMaster in the Trump White House by pro-Israel megabillionaire Sheldon Adelson because he didn't consider McMaster supportive enough of Israel. By he, I'm referring to Adelson, not Trump. Not surprisingly, our media has not told you the whole story. It rarely does when Israel's involved behind the scenes, and for that you need to follow the Israeli press in English. So I suspect this is the first time you're hearing that this threat is an Israeli concoction, since Prime Minister Netanyahu would like nothing better than to see the U.S. wage war on its enemy, Iran. According to Barik Ravid of Israel's TV Channel 13 and confirmed by the Jerusalem Post and other Israeli publications, senior Israeli officials told him that, quote, Israel passed information on an alleged Iranian plot to attack U.S. interests in the Gulf to the U.S. before Bolton threatened Iran with unrelenting force should such an attack occur. Bolton's unusual and aggressive statement, said Ravid, including news that the U.S. would move an aircraft carrier to the region. Information about possible Iranian plots against the U.S. or its allies in the Gulf were raised 2 weeks ago in talks held at the White House between an Israeli delegation headed by National Security Advisor Meir Ben-Shabbat and a U.S. team led by Bolton, the Israeli officials told me, said Ravid. An Israeli official told me Mossad drew several scenarios for what the Iranians might be planning, he added, and cited that official as saying, quote, quote, it is still unclear to us what the Iranians are trying to do and how they are planning to do it, but it is clear to us that the Iranian temperature is on the rise as a result of the growing U.S. pressure campaign against them, and they are considering retaliating against U.S. interests in the Gulf, end quote. As I reported to you in an earlier program, the Pentagon and the CIA have been opposed to the Trump administration's recent actions toward Iran, including declaring the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps to be a terrorist group, fearing that this will endanger U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria. But their reticence has stirred next to no comment in the media. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Week in Palestine.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a recording of Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the newly elected and only Palestinian member of the House of Representatives, speaking to a delegation who had come to Washington on a lobbying mission. One of the members of the delegation sent the recording of the session, and I thought it really reflected her approach to her job as a congresswoman. So here is Representative Tlaib speaking to the delegation who had come to visit her in her office in Washington, D.C.
I can tell you, I always tell people they didn't just let any Arabiya in Congress, they let a Falaha in Congress. Very, very proud of this incredible opportunity. But I got to tell you, I think when I go to Palestina, I'm Americania. But when I'm in Congress, I'm so much more Palestinian than I am anywhere else in the world. but I'm really proud to be able to somehow uplift the incredible hardship and pain of being oppressed as Palestinians are every single day. Feeling less than. When I ran for Congress and even before that, I was always speaking truth to power. I always was very much at the center of any kind of movement where oppression or, again, this, I would call myself a humanist, this anything that impacted people and feeling less equal and less humane in many ways of some of the actions. When I won my city, Muftiya, in Beit Ur al-Fuqa, not Tehta, in Beit Ur, she, she goes, Halas, halas, Palestine. I said, Sifti. I was like, that's not how it works. I was like, Palestine's not free until we do this movement. And there's an incredible woman by the name of Grace Lee Boggs in the city of Detroit who always said, you know, different movements, if it's not the women's rights movement, it's not the civil rights movement, it's not even just pushing back against anti-blackness in our country that continues to be prevalent, it is always from movements outside the halls of Congress, outside of the White House. It isn't inside. It is with all of you. So, yes, I'm there. I'm one of you. I call it, like, now an activist is now in Congress. But many of you are the reason that somebody like me could even be possible, that I have the courage to constantly speak truth about what is happening in Palestine every single day. You know, being the eldest of 14, mashallah, I've been taking care of people all my life. Yeah. I don't know how many of you know. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they, Palestinians are not going anywhere. We really do produce. Not one or five, right? Like, five, like, we produce. they can't erase us. And so I can tell you, getting people through everyday issues is what I've been doing for my family since being in the Michigan legislature and now in Congress. I have families that have been born in this country and still feel the sense of inequality because of their income class, because of their faith, or because of anything that they're going through, their immigration status, whatever it is. And so much of me growing up in that community in Detroit, and then you stick a little bit of Palestinian in you, I mean, you know, in my blood, I'm a warrior. And no one will tell me not to be able, not to, you know, like, shush me or be quiet. Every time they do, I kind of escalate it. But it's because of the fact that I was raised in a predominantly black community where every corner is a reminder of the civil rights movement. And I say this to all of you because today so many of you came to visit me and said, well, what can we do? And I said to the every single one, like, what is AMP doing about what's happening at the border? You know, like, really, because to me, that's another form of what's happening in Gaza, where people are literally getting children ripped apart from them, but dealing with the fact that they're being caged and all of the heart, everything, the tragedy, the fact that when they cry for their parents, they're being injected with medicine, like literally drugs, to make them stop crying for their parents. That's what our country is doing right here. And I say this to all of you, is like, I think of Palestine when I see that. I get so emotional because I think to myself, why is this happening right on our watch? So you all need to understand the way we succeed is when we speak up for others. When we speak up for others. Police brutality, when it's anti-immigrant movement, when it's anything, even homophobia, all of it, you have to understand. We have to speak up. And we do it by bringing Palestine at the forefront. When I say to people, do you know what it feels like to go to Palestine with my mother who has to get in a separate line with a different colored passport that literally is going through checkpoints? Do you know what it feels like? Well, my African-American teachers knew what that felt like to be in a segregated community. That's how you connect this movement to what's happening. And that's what we need to be doing every single day. A lot of you younger people know that. You're on campuses organizing around, I mean, even the economic boycott movement. My God, if we didn't have the Montgomery bus boycott, where could we have been without that? And if nobody, no one should say to us that that isn't protected to First Amendment right. It absolutely is. You know, my family is super excited about my delegation to Palestine. And I can tell you, for all of those, as your visiting members of Congress, when they want to hear be balanced, tell them, go on the trip. Go hear another side of the story that you never have heard of, because this is an opportunity. Never in history of the United States Congress is there now a member with a living grandmother in the West Bank and occupied territories of Palestine. This is an opportunity to open up your eyes, to see why there's still a cry after over 50 years of occupation, a cry for Palestinian human rights, for equality, for justice. This is their opportunity to hear a side that they may not have been exposed to ever in history of their service to their districts. And so it is important that all of you, as you're sharing your stories, as you're talking to members of Congress, please, you know, share those stories, but also ask them to open their eyes to the other side. And I say that because I hear so many people wanting to choose sides. And I said, well, why don't you start with your values? Because if you start with your values at the end, you would all agree that Palestinians deserve equality and deserve human rights and don't deserve to feel less than in their country that they were born in for 3 or 4 or 5, 6, sometimes 100 generations. So I'm really pleased that you're all here. I got to tell you, next time you got to check with me on the schedule, folks. Like, members of Congress don't get in really until tonight. So you should have stayed for one more day. That's why it seems so empty and like it looks like we're not doing. It's because tonight is our first vote is tonight. And so we're here until Tuesday and then Wednesday, usually we until Thursday. But Tuesday, Wednesday is always your best bet if you fly in. That way you can actually talk to the members of Congress, not just staff people. So just remember that it's very important because I want you guys to be seen. You know, I always tell people this is an institution that may not have been ready for someone like me. And really, in all different ways. But I want you all to be heard and be seen, and so it's important. And for all the young people that came, one of them told me that the member didn't want to meet with them or the staff didn't want to meet with them. I said, well, next time go outside of the room and in front of their plaque and say, we're here being American, civically engaged people, and they don't want to meet with us, and tweet it. I think if you're in front of a member of Congress's office and their staff and nobody really wants to pay attention to you, in appointment or no appointment, at least having some sort of engagement, if you're feeling like you're not being heard or seen, then, you know, share that publicly because it actually makes them better public servants when you do that. It makes them hear you much better. I know many of you heard this joke, but, you know, my mother really, really, truly believes, like, it's so funny. She's like, all the time, she goes, Shifty, Shifty. I'm like, I mean Shifty, Shifty mean your mom. And she goes, have you seen him? Have you seen him? And I was like, Mama, because Trump, because that's how I say it. And I was like, and she's like, are you talking about Trump, Mom? And she's like, yeah, Mama, Shifty. I said, no, Mama, he doesn't walk in the halls of Congress. He's not, like, walking around. And my mom is so sad because it's funny and sad at the same time. She's actually afraid of her own president. She's afraid of him. And that is scary that you're afraid for the first time ever, you know, like ever. Afraid, I mean, yeah, you're afraid, but afraid of the leader of our country and afraid of her daughter being somehow, you know, him seeing me and things like that. I said, Mama, you can't do nothing to me. I'm in Congress. And so, yeah. It's funny, and she really believes that the way to fix all of this, from all the hate, if you're Arab, you're not Muslim, whatever it is, all the different levels of hate, she really believes, like, Palestine would be, the issue around Palestine would be just completely fixed if people just knew that Jesus was born in Palestine. And honest to God, she tells everybody, and the guy yelled at her to take off her hijab at a supermarket, and she's like, you don't understand, Jesus was born in my country. And my mom really believes that we can just let people know that all of a sudden the lights will come in through the windows and things will shine and all of a sudden Palestine will be free again. But thank you all so much for your incredible advocacy, for your strength and your courage. Thank you.
That was Congressional Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan speaking to a delegation which was visiting her in her office in Washington, D.C. And now the feature presentation, which this morning is an address to a conference organized by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C., by Brad Parker of Defense for Children International, an advocacy and legal group seeking to defend Palestinian children who continue to face high incarceration rates imposed by the Israeli military. We begin with an introduction by Dale Spruzansky.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for sticking with us through a long day. And we're going to get started here with another important topic of discussion. and that is legislative efforts to help Palestinians, especially innocent Palestinian children, which you think would not be a controversial task, but it is. In 2017, Representative Betty McCollum of Minnesota introduced the Promoting Human Rights by Ending Israeli Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act in the House of Representatives. This piece of legislation would have prevented U.S. funds from being used to support the detention, interrogation, or ill treatment of Palestinian children by the Israeli military, which of course receives at least $3.8 billion a year in U.S. aid. 30 members of Congress co-sponsored this bill. And there's no questioning the urgency of this legislation. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, Israel prosecutes roughly 700 Palestinian children a year in its military courts, and 75% of those children report experiencing some form of abuse. So here to elaborate on this is Brad Parker. He's Senior Advisor, Policy and Advocacy at Defense for Children International, one of the organizations that endorsed Representative McCollum's bill. He specializes in issues of juvenile justice and grave violations against children during armed conflict, and leads his organization's legal advocacy efforts for Palestinian children's rights. He will discuss lessons activists can take away from the Promoting Human Rights Act that McCollum introduced. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm happy to see folks with smiles, and it feels that there is still some energy here. So I'll try to move quickly through the next 20 minutes or so and keep it snappy so we can get to some questions. So first, just to explain the organization that I work for, Defense for Children International Palestine is a local Palestinian child rights organization. It was founded in 1991 specifically to provide legal aid to Palestinian children charged in the Israeli military courts. So everything that I'll talk about around military detention comes from that experience of having lawyers defend Palestinian children in the military courts. We do court visits, represent kids. We do prison visits. We collect affidavits, questionnaires, information on the ill treatment that they face. So our entire sort of work is grounded in that legal aid experience. Over the past few decades, many people generally deemed engagement with lawmakers in the U.S. around Palestinian rights issues as futile. Even recently, many people have avoided it. Many people in this room probably avoid it. I won't ask for a show of hands, but I assume that if you have engaged with sort of direct outreach to your members of Congress, it's been a bit of a stressful experience at times. For the same reason, Defense for Children International Palestine and other local Palestinian human rights organizations also did not prioritize engagement with lawmakers in the U.S. We focused a lot of efforts in different European countries through the EU, UN, human rights mechanisms, but never really brought something clear, direct, and proactive to American policymakers. There's been a lot of necessary effort that's been put into public education campaigns in the U.S., speaking tours, BDS efforts, which all have helped build and expand a broad U.S.-based movement demanding equality, freedom, and justice for Palestinians. In this context, DCI Palestine was sort of wondering what our role could be if we had a permanent presence in the U.S. So really starting as early as 2009, following Israeli military offensive on Gaza, December 2008 into January 2009, Operation Cast Lead, we saw openings in the U.S. Increasing use of social media allowed Palestinians to share their human experience of occupation, of military offensives. Students for Justice in Palestine organizing and developing networks among college campuses all started to create more space where a local Palestinian organization like DCI Palestine could come and have a contribution with our evidence base that we use. We looked at the landscape of what was happening in the U.S., and we wanted to try to figure out how we could have the most impact. We didn't want to be redundant. We wanted to complement the efforts that were happening. We have a focus and a mandate to specifically monitor rights violations against children, and we saw that as a really clear issue to bring to Americans, where congressional advocacy, working with policymakers, can be quite contentious. So our goal was to complement efforts that were already happening, and that's sort of where we arrived at a congressional advocacy campaign. We wanted to create something that would leverage the ongoing work towards political action and political change. So in 2014, a handful of individuals organized by the American Defense Service Committee and Defense for Children International Palestine came together in Chicago with the intention of building an evidence-based, rights-based congressional advocacy campaign. We wanted to demonstrate not only that it wasn't futile to engage with members of Congress on Palestinian rights, but that it was entirely necessary if we wanted to build the political power to force the change that was needed. So from these initial discussions, our No Way to Treat a Child campaign was born. We launched in 2015, and the goal was to engage members of Congress on a narrowly tailored and compelling child rights issue, like widespread and systematic ill treatment of Palestinian children arrested by Israeli forces and prosecuted in military courts. In the first 3 years, the campaign has mobilized an extensive network of people across the U.S. through this strategic congressional advocacy. As Dale had mentioned, in November 2017, we celebrated a historic moment when Representative Betty McCollum introduced H.R. 4391. My task here is to share lessons that activists and others can take away from this legislation. So to do that, I want to sort of tell you how we did it. So the first kind of piece is our success is entirely built around evidence-based, rights-based advocacy. So what is that? So when meeting with policy and decision makers around the world, including members of Congress and their staff, I utilize the human rights documentation that we collect from children and families and our lawyers' documentation that they bring. And that's the basis for our discussions. We use international humanitarian law, international human rights law, universal rights protections that apply to any person, right? Combined with the evidence that we bring. And that human rights law, that humanitarian law, is the guide, right? It's not about final status issues or a legacy of Oslo, right? It's not these sort of traditional policy decisions that go into discussions around Israel-Palestine. We want that policymakers to put those issues to the side. Issues of borders, territory, Jerusalem, security, Israel as a Jewish state, all of these are essentially irrelevant to a rights-based approach. So what is a rights-based approach? Generally, it's an approach that utilizes international human rights law as a framework to advance and operationalize the promotion and protection of universal human rights for all persons. So-called final status issues are the context and reference point that many following the Israel and Palestine portfolio bring to the table. And yes, resolution of these issues would have ramifications for individual Palestinian rights. However, the real main point is that if you're trying to advance Palestinian human rights by highlighting the human impact of Israeli occupation, then the main point is that realization of human rights is not contingent on the resolution of these final status issues. So we use international law, we use the evidence that we collect to really proactively shape the conversation that we have with these policymakers in a way that doesn't necessarily contradict their policy positions. So pragmatically, a human rights-based approach provides a framework to concretely articulate the human rights denials and violations inherent in Israeli military occupation. It provides a framework to examine systemic inequality, discrimination, oppression, and other issues that are deeply rooted in Israeli military occupation of Palestinians. It allows us to use a framework to lay out rights and wrongs that relatedly lets us advocate and identify specific policies and pass forward. And really what we're trying to have come across through this evidence-based, rights-based advocacy is that at the heart of it, Palestinians are entitled to universal human rights regardless of whether a policy or decision maker sort of emphatically supports a two-state solution or not. Right? We want to remove that as an obstacle because in the end, right, it's about human rights, equality, justice, freedom, and human dignity. So that... So in that, our goal is to empower members of Congress to adopt this rights-based discourse so that they can acknowledge that Palestinians are, for example, entitled to basic and fundamental rights like equality, civil and political rights, freedom from torture, ill treatment. It's meant to free them up and empower them to speak out on things that are happening without being hemmed in by kind of the constraints of Washington when it comes to policy that's traditionally been the norm for Israel-Palestine. So connecting this rights-based discourse to specific human experience is kind of where we've been successful. So how many people, show of hands, know the name Tariq Abu Qader? A Palestinian-American teen beaten in Jerusalem, video went viral in summer 2014. Right? In one of our first congressional, when we launched the campaign in June 2015, Tariq and his mother were part of the congressional briefing that we organized in Washington. So connecting kind of the rights-based discourse, the evidence with the human experience is the thing that's been compelling in our work. Others sort of along the way, including Ahed Tamimi, kind of the most recent high-profile detention of a child, and then Fawzi al-Junaidi, who is the boy in this photo that went viral. A DCI Palestine attorney, my colleague Farah Bayadzi, represented him in the military courts. Right, these are the stories that we try to bring to these policymakers. So lesson one. Integrate as best you can a rights-based discourse into your efforts and center those efforts around these compelling human stories. Because in the end, I think connecting, whether it's child rights issues, other issues, you can show the human impact of policies of occupation. It's a much more visceral, dynamic, real message that you're bringing to these policymakers. So that's sort of the strategy and thinking behind the campaign and the way that we created it. To actually build the campaign, to use this congressional advocacy engagement to mobilize people, we had to create vehicles to do so. So we wanted to create vehicles that facilitated engagement, discussion with lawmakers, and allowed that relationship building that's so key to doing political work to create political change. From using congressional briefings, that allowed us to create a presence on Capitol Hill. We organized Dear Colleague letters, right? Members of Congress signing on to letters, statements, sending them to, you know, in our case, the first Dear Colleague letter we did was sent to Secretary of State John Kerry at the time. We went into that June 2015 launch in D.C., hoping to get one member of Congress to sign on to that letter. We ended up with 19, right? And that was sort of the starting point. We went from there. That letter was initiated by Representative Betty McCollum. It highlighted the ill treatment of Palestinian child prisoners in the Israeli military detention system. and essentially urged the State Department to elevate the human rights of Palestinian child detainees to a priority status within bilateral discussions between the State Department and Israeli authorities. At the time, it felt sort of groundbreaking. And I think it was. we shocked ourselves a bit, but it also sort of confirmed the things that we knew or thought to be true. If we could have narrow, sort of compelling issues, put them to policymakers, like we could have a positive response. So we took that letter, we sort of used it to mobilize people throughout the U.S., through the end of 2015 into early 2016, you know, we sort of used that letter just to show and say, you know, this isn't futile. We can do this. A lot of the people that that first meeting in Chicago in 2014, you know, when I said we wanted to focus on Congress, there were some laughs. Some people got up and walked out. And after we had that first year colleague letter, right, those people were back in the room and said, we had no idea that this could be possible right now. So that was the hope we were trying to create and build on and use to sort of further things. So 2016, we needed another vehicle. We did another dear colleague letter. That time it was sent to President Obama, also led again by Representative Betty McCollum, letter called for the creation of a special envoy for Palestinian youth in the Department of State to follow, monitor, and report on what at the time was a deteriorating situation across the West Bank for not only Palestinian children, but Palestinians generally. That work essentially created the landscape where legislation became possible. Looking at the 2016 election, we knew we were going to have to probably change tactics, try to get a bit bolder. And then once the Trump administration came in, we sort of had to throw plans out and force ourselves to be even more creative. We knew we needed something longer term. Right. These dear colleague letters, they sort of last for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, maybe a couple months, and then you get the signers and they get sent. They're sort of quick reactions, or they can be sort of proactive statements on something, but we really needed that long-term organizing vehicle to push things forward. And that came in H.R. 4391. So we worked with Betty McCollum's staff to draft and eventually introduce the bill. And that's been sort of over the past year, 15 months or so, what we've used to mobilize people throughout the U.S. So if you're not familiar with the bill, it's no longer a live bill. We'll be working to reintroduce a version hopefully in the coming weeks. But H.R. 4391 sought to ensure U.S. taxpayer funds are not be used to support grave violations of human rights against Palestinian children detained by Israeli forces. The way that the bill works is that it required the Secretary of State to certify that no funds from the foreign military financing package that Israel receives from the U.S. are used to support certain prohibited practices in the bill. Those prohibited practices are torture, ill treatment, denying access to counsel, administrative detention or detention without charge, solitary confinement for interrogation purposes, right? These are things that universally are violations not just of human rights law, but international humanitarian law, Geneva Conventions. They violate the provisions of the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court. If you're a Palestinian child arrested, detained, and charged with throwing stones, for example, in the military courts, you have the right not to be tortured. Right? It doesn't matter the gravity of the offense. Whatever you're alleged to have done, you have that absolute prohibition against torture. And that's the thing that we really want to sort of hone in on. Because on one level, it makes things very clear. Right? If you support this legislation, you're standing up against the torture of children. If you don't support this legislation, you're essentially condoning these policies and practices that have been documented for decades as being widespread, systematic, and institutionalized within the Israeli military detention system. And that stark sort of polarized issue, right, is where we want to create our campaign and move things forward. Because we know that not everybody in Congress is going to jump on the bill and support the things that we're saying from a policy perspective.
Who is that that's talking?
Somebody from DCI but International.
Remember we want something that if they're going to say no to it, right, there's a cost. Oh, or there's something that we can use to take back in district and mobilize people around that ridiculous thing that they use to justify that treatment. And that's sort of where the work for advocates, activists come in. So my lesson two would be that we need sustained and regular engagement with lawmakers and their staff, both in Washington and locally in district. That's really what facilitates the political work that's necessary. We need to create space. They need to know that you'll be talking to them. You'll be in their office. If something happens, right, you're going to be there. That's really what the campaign is meant to do. We know we don't have the political power yet to really force that change. It's growing. There's a lot of movement happening, right? But we really do need the political work to be done side by side, other efforts to force that change that we need. And maybe just as a show of hands, how many people have contacted their member of Congress this week?
One of those guys who is British and talking about the treatment of children.
Okay. So not many. How many people contacted a member of Congress this month? Okay. Better. How many people have a specific contact in the local district office or DC office where they know the name, they know the phone number, they know the email? Hey, not bad. How many people think we can do better? How many people think we need to do better? Right? I think that's really the core of it, right? How many people emailed this conference to their staff, their representative? How many people flagged this conference for staffers in D.C.? Right? We can all do that. And that's sort of the sustained. You take the email that Dale sends. You take the email for the congressional office, right? That's, you're their constituents. They have to listen to you. They don't have to agree with you. They have to listen to you, right? You forward that email from Dale and say, I would like somebody in this office to attend and report back, right? This is how we create that sustained engagement. That's how we develop the relationships, show that there's space, right, to discuss Palestinian rights issues, and that's how we do the political work to force the change that we need. Let's see. So sustain engagements, build relationships, right? That's all at the core of the campaign that we've created and why it's successful. Anything you can do to create vehicles, right? So with the campaign, the vehicle we created was Dear Colleague letters, congressional briefings, legislation, and now, right, the goal and task for all of you is to figure out how to create vehicles locally. If you have a film screening, right, invite the local folks from the district office to the event. It doesn't matter if they come or not, right? Let them know about it. Use that to create that space to have that engagement with the things that you're already doing. And then the last sort of lesson that really has allowed us to do what we've done is having advocates speaking from personal experience on the ground, right? I've been to the West Bank. I've seen children that have been detained. I've been to Hebron. I've seen children going to school, walking through military checkpoints. Okay? Use that personal experience as part of your engagement with policymakers. So if you haven't gone, go. Eyewitness Palestine has a table. You can talk to them about a June trip. And there's many different delegations that go to the region each year. So I'll stop there and look forward to questions.
Thank you very much. I guess we'll begin here. Most of the people, I think, who signed on the bill were more to the left side of the Democratic Party, of those 30 members that signed the Holmes bill. What was the engagement like with other sort of Democrats, other Democrats? I'm thinking the Ted Deutsches, the Elliott Engels, who were pro-Israel but otherwise very liberal. What was the reaction and your engagement with them?
A hard no would be the way to probably put it, most diplomatic. I think, you know, obviously we know that we work in congressional advocacy related to Palestinian rights. It's not going to be well received by the majority of even Democratic progressive members. So the challenge is really working with constituents in those districts, right, where they're putting questions at town halls to the Elliott Engels, the Jerry Nadlers, folks that, you know, do support, you know, a non-rights respecting policy related to Palestinians, and use the sort of polarized nature of, you know, you either support torture or you're against torture, right? There's sort of no in between, and use that to force conversations, even if they're not in agreement, right? There's still utility in educating, you know, the constituents in that district around the issues that are happening on the ground, but also that their so-called progressive member of Congress is creating this pretty extreme exception for Israeli forces, at least on this issue. And that's really, I think, for what we're trying to do
still playing, isn't it?
The moment we're in.
No, that was actually quite interesting, that going on
because
the ground.
It's really about, in some ways, exploiting congressional advocacy and the direct engagement. To just build a bigger movement of people demanding rights and justice for the Palestinians.
I assume there's a similar hard no from Republicans that were maybe engaged. Yeah. Okay.
2020. He worked with your man.
Okay. Yeah, for Republicans, yes. Yeah. There's, I mean, there's been outreach, and this is where some of our partners, faith-based partners particularly, have been instrumental in trying to get, and I may just sit down again. some of the different churches that we partner with, different mainline Protestant denominations, have been doing a lot of outreach to Republican offices, making the case for why this bill is necessary, and why this bill also, you know, is situated within existing U.S. law. As a means to facilitate conversations there with the understanding that it's probably very unlikely that we have a Republican member of Congress join as a co-sponsor. And
someone wants to know if there was, while you were doing this effort on the Hill, any pushback, I guess, from AIPAC or any other pro-Israel group, were they making their views known on this?
Yeah, right. We know the context with which we work. AIPAC, J Street, you know, everybody works with members of Congress on their particular issues. So if you look, you can find online probably different AIPAC talking points around the bill, around military detention. And this is sort of the, when I talk about empowering members of Congress to sort of hold their ground, this is where having it be focused on something like an absolute prohibition of torture really is the thing that allows them to do that, right? So, what are you going to say to justify the torture of a child? In some ways, let AIPAC try to do that, right? Because it just reaffirms everything that we're saying about a rights-based approach to human rights for Palestinians, but also foreign policy generally. So in some ways, the pushback that we've had from AIPAC, at least with the more progressive offices, Democratic offices, really just reaffirms everything that we're saying. So in some ways, they're one of our stronger allies on the issue.
Someone would like to know if you think a campaign similar to A Way to Treat a Child could be used to fight against the collective punishment of people living in Gaza.
I mean, I think the challenge is we have to think creatively and figure out how we can do it. I don't I think my short answer is yes, right? You find the way. I think the thing that we've tried to do is show that we don't have to always be reactionary. We don't always have to be on the defensive. Right? We can be proactive. We can create our own vehicles, shift the burdens from ourselves to policymakers, to lawmakers, and say, you know, where do you stand on this? Right? And that's the political work we need to do. And for sure, there's a way to do it around government.
I won't set the clock. I assume I will.
We also work on documenting
would you agree?
Violations against children in Gaza.
Right. If you wake up at 7 and you want to get up, you get up.
As part of the Gaza March of Return protests, right? This is all something that we're trying to figure out what we can do around congressional advocacy. So, very timely question, and I think it can be done. And we just have to think creatively how to do it.
One final question. Someone wants to know if you've seen any difference in approach on the ground with the Israeli military and children ever since this campaign has started.
No. I think that's the constant. Ill treatment is widespread, systematic, and institutionalized. Rather than address the violations that are ongoing, the physical violence that children face, the work is put into criticizing the messenger. So whether it's DCI Palestine or Israeli human rights organizations, right, civil society space within Israel, within the occupied Palestinian territory is shrinking dramatically. Human rights organizations are under attack in many ways, and extreme amounts of energy and effort are put into chilling speech, silencing folks, rather than just, you know, implementing rights-respecting policies. And you know, that it's obvious, I think, why policies aren't reformed. The goal isn't that, you know, the military courts, for example, are holding children accountable for specific wrongdoing, right? The goal of the military courts and the military law is to work to control the Palestinian population. If you arrest 700 to, you know, even 1,000 15-year-old adolescent boys from their homes in the middle of the night, ill-treat 3 out of 4 of them, their fathers can't save them, their mothers can't save them, right? Their community can't save them. You're stripping down everything that those children have as protections in their community. And that fragmentation of families, fragmentations of communities, that's the goal. Right? Military courts targeting children for arrest, it's really about controlling the Palestinian population. It's not about specific wrongdoing.
You have been listening to Brad Parker of Defense for Children International speaking about his work defending children in Palestine who face large incarceration rates under Israeli occupation. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio.
What has become of England? The land of Boadicea, Drake, Marlborough, Wellington. We allow ourselves to be led by timid grey men and dictated to by Basques, Walloons and Flems. We bow to inbred chinless aristocrats just because centuries ago their ancestors stole some sheep or shagged the king or vice versa or both. We're up to our necks in tradition and deference. Well, I intend to sweep all that away. England must arise.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican and Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A very nervous-looking Jeremy Hunt meets Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State. Can anything but war be the result? Mike Pompeo at the State Department. Well, his only policy seems to be blaming the rest of the world for US government failings, and like a mad dog, threatening with sanctions or war every country that pursues its own policies. So, it's to be a trade war with China, and a nuclear-powered Nimitz-class carrier strike force is chugging off on the long voyage to the Persian Gulf. We hear some voices too from Tehran tonight, from the university, and from Iran's Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, who we never see on the BBC. They're threatening to resume uranium enrichment if the EU resumes sanctions, as the US is trying to force them to. Plus, the US talk show host, shock jock, right-wing Alex Jones interviews Nigel Farage. And Israel, again, bombards the vast concentration camps, as described on this show, known as Gaza. But a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel with Daniela Ganser at the end. How can we reform the United Nations Security Council, particularly to actually enforce its own charter, which bans the sorts of wars of aggression and invasion the United States has been waging for the last 60 years? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesday at noon this week. Jack Windle from Bristol Acorn Union supports tenants like Martin Summers here. He chooses the Ragged Trousered Philanthropist as his book of dissent for the Save Redland Library campaign. Former Swiss banker Manfred Petrisch gives us his take on Easter's suspicious terrorist attacks. And Justin Walker from the West Country's British Constitution Group has some controversial views on Extinction Rebellion and climate change. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it from dialectradio.co.uk. Right now. But Martin, I think we should probably start with this whole attack on Gaza this week. And it's apparently in response to a whole load of rockets. Do we know what is the point, I suppose, is the obvious question, for the Palestinians to be firing rockets when they know that they're going to get probably a massive bombardment by artillery and airstrikes in response?
Well, I think that's news management, because in actual fact, the Palestinian view is that they came under attack first and they responded. Now, I think that it's always presented as Israel responds to Palestinian attacks.
Is there actually any point in the Palestinians responding, knowing that probably ten times more Palestinians will be killed in a response than possibly the Israelis in the first place?
Well, you've got to bear in mind that you haven't got unified command in Gaza, so you've got Hamas and you've also got Islamic Jihad, who are actually not under the control of Hamas, and they do stuff that Hamas don't actually agree with. But actually what happens after these confrontations is that ceasefires are often agreed. In actual fact, that you know, it's an ongoing battle. And, of course, if there's going to be no peace, then there's going to be war. And if there's going to be war, it can't just be one side doing the shooting. They've been trying to do peaceful demonstrations for months, being shot down by Israeli snipers. And, frankly, the decision whether they're going to fight back is a one for the Gazans. There was not much point the Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto rising up against the Germans. They were never going to win. They were all going to be killed, and that's pretty much what happened. But they've got a right to defend themselves, and the people in Gaza have got a similar right.
Well, thankfully now the truce is holding. Al Jazeera say Israel is lifting restrictions on Gaza fishing. But at the end of the day, this isn't really an equal balance of power, is it? When one does talk about a war or a battle, that isn't really the right word to describe what's happening here. It's more of a massacre.
Well, it is, because one side has got all the weaponry and the other side's got hardly anything. But you've got to remember that the line that divides Gaza from Israel is not an international border. It's simply where the Israeli army ended up in their various incursions into Palestinian territory. And many of the people inside Gaza used to have farms and houses on the other side of the border. So when they shoot missiles at the Israelis who are in their farms and houses, that's their farms and houses that were taken off them. And there's no rules that say the Israelis can have that. It's just the rule of force. And ultimately, of course, if there's going to be a world war, which there well might be, maybe the state of Israel won't exist at the end of a world war, because it's not just Palestinians who are unhappy with them. They're actually cruising for a bruising, as well, no doubt we're going to discuss with various other actors in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Well, it's interesting to see that the spokesman for the Israeli government was a chap called Michael Freeman. This is one of the things the Israelis managed to do, which I think is actually a kind of propaganda ploy, really, is he's actually a Brit. It sounds like he's brought up and he's English, which I suppose for anyone watching the news would make them think, well, actually, he's one of us, he's on our side, etc. He's not got an Israeli accent. It doesn't look like he was brought up there at all.
Well, I don't know who this guy is, but as you well know, there are plenty of people of Israeli origin living in Britain, and why not, and so on. It's an international world. But
well, this is the other way around. I mean, well, anyway, let's have a listen to what he had to say.
Let's see
on
what
Channel 4
say.
News this week, speaking to Jackie Long.
Michael Freeman from the Israeli embassy in London is with me now. Mr. Freeman, the death toll is rising. I assume you regret the deaths on both sides.
Absolutely. The death of any innocent is a terrible tragedy. And Hamas bears full responsibility, along with Islamic Jihad, for this round where they have launched hundreds of rockets at Israeli civilian populations.
I mean, that's an argument that you make, and you make it every time there is an incident like this. The question is always whether the response from the Israelis has been proportionate. And we heard there the Israeli Prime Minister has ordered the military to continue its massive strikes. And that can only mean a rising death toll.
Well, this is up to Hamas to try and stop this. You know, if Hamas and Islamic Jihad were to stop the rockets now, that would be the end. Hamas are targeting Israeli civilians. They've fired over 600 rockets, and we have currently over 2.5 million Israelis in bomb shelters, and we are acting as any country would act to defend its population.
I mean, there is a grim familiarity to these incidents, isn't there? They're often followed by mediation, we know, through the Egyptians and the UN. But fundamentally, nothing seems to change over the crucial issue of the blockade, which I think you would concede causes enormous suffering, but also builds resentment. Even in self-interest, isn't there an argument for easing the blockade?
Well, we need to remember where what you call the blockade came from. In 2005, Israel withdrew from Gaza, withdrew all of our settlers, all of our soldiers, all of our civilians, everybody withdrew. And there was no blockade. Everything was completely open. And what happened was Hamas started firing rockets and started launching attacks at Israel. And in response, like any other country, Israel said, we're not going to allow you to bring in rockets and missiles. You know, every day, hundreds of trucks go into Gaza. They bring in food and medicine and everything that the population needs. So the question really is...
But that is not true. People are...
Martin, this is an interesting... what he's saying here is effectively that the Hamas and the Palestinians have abused the trust that was given them in 2005.
Well, I don't agree with that. Basically, the blockade is on things like medicines and food. It's a medieval siege, effectively. And as you pointed out earlier, the amount of weaponry that the Palestinians have actually got is pitiful. And you could argue that it's a waste of time. Nobody's been killed by any of these rockets. Let's just point that out.
Actually, it looks like one Israeli was killed and 19 Palestinians this time.
All right, so it's 19-1. But, of course, you've got to remember that Gaza, as I said earlier, the border between Gaza and Israel is not an international border. It's just where the Israeli army ended up in their campaign of conquest. The state of Israel was recognised in 1948 in very clear borders, nowhere near what is currently
Gaza. But the Israelis
Gaza.
Will see this as a kill ratio of 20-1 and a victory.
Well, the problem is for the Palestinians they're on hiding to nothing because nobody takes them seriously. And of course, when similar things were being done by Serbia in Kosovo and in Bosnia, we went to war with Serbia. The British RAF bombed Serbia for 73 days. We killed 10,000 civilians. 10,000 Serbian civilians were killed. But you know what? They released Kosovo and they packed back down in Bosnia. Maybe that's the only language the Israelis understand. If they had 10,000 civilian casualties from a British airstrike and a US airstrike, then perhaps they'd withdraw into the borders in 1948 that they agreed that they would accept. Because that's everything they've taken since 1948 has been taken by force.
Okay, back now to Michael Freeman from the Israeli spokesman and Jackie Long at Channel 4 News.
are hungry. People are starving. There is an economic wound in Gaza that needs to be healed, doesn't there?
Absolutely. And that responsibility lies squarely with Hamas. If Hamas were to stop firing rockets, if Hamas were to stop investing, you know, they get billions of dollars in aid every single year. And rather than taking that aid and investing it in schools or hospitals or food, they build terror tunnels, they build missiles, and they fire them at Israel. You know, if they wanted
to... There is an argument made by many analysts that Hamas fire rockets because it is the only way that they can get the Israelis to even remember that there are people living in real difficulty in the Gaza Strip.
Well, we know there are people living in difficulty in the Gaza Strip. We wouldn't deny that. But we would say that.
But isn't there an argument for easing their difficulty, which we might would, we, lessen
well,
the tensions?
Only recently we changed the guidelines for allowing Palestinian fishermen to have more area to fish in. We allowed greater access through the border. We allowed more people to come in.
And that's
Israel.
All part of these ceasefire negotiations.
These are all part of the
it?
Ceasefire negotiations.
But
and
the,
we would...
the International Crisis Group suggests that Israel is defaulting on promises to ease the blockade perhaps even further. And their argument is that Hamas used rocket fire as a means of putting pressure on you. So it is in your own self-interest.
Well, let's hear what Hamas say. Let's not listen to what other people say. Hamas are very open. They say that their aim is to destroy Israel. Their aim is to wipe Israel off the map. And their aim is to kill every single Jew around the world. So for them, the rockets aren't about putting pressure. Because, again, if this was about pressure, you know, as you know, Gaza has a border with Egypt. And the border with Egypt has also been closed.
Right.
And they've never fired a single rocket into Gaza, into Egypt. Not one. So the issue is
Michael,
clearly not about
Freeman,
the border.
I'll have to...
Well, isn't that interesting? On one level, the Israelis say that nobody's to talk to Hamas. Hamas won the last democratic election in Palestine in 96, I think it was, and therefore they are, in theory, the democratic government. Of course, they keep pushing that you know that we've got to have democracy in the whole of the Arab world, including armed uprisings against Gaddafi and all the rest of it. But Hamas, who were the elected leadership, the Israelis won't talk to them, and they won't recognise them. There's anybody who talks to them Britain won't talk to them for the same reasons. Then, of course, in actual practice, they do talk to them, just like the British talked to the IRA for years and years and years behind the scenes whilst pretending they weren't talking to them. Ultimately, the question is, does the state of Israel, all that stuff, they want to kill every Israeli and get rid of the state of Israel. Hamas have said, if you do a deal with us, like recognising a Palestinian state, then, but in reciprocation, we might recognise a rump Israeli state. But it's got to be within the borders that were agreed in 1948, and that means that everybody who's living outside Gaza, the Israelis that built all their homes and farms and factories just on the land that people in Gaza used to own, they will have to withdraw into the borders of 1948. Serbia had to withdraw from Kosovo. Israel's got to withdraw from Palestine. It's as simple as that. There's one rule. The rules have got to be absolutely the same. And we went to war. I said earlier, we went to war with Serbia and had a 73-day bombing campaign. Never mind a few rockets. We bombed their television station. Do you remember? We knocked the television station out and killed all their weather girls.
Martin, it's actually worse than what you just said. Hamas don't want to kill all Israelis. They want to kill all Jews around the world, according to the Israeli government spokesman.
Well, that's just rubbish, isn't it? And just shows how what bad faith they talk.
Jackie Long should really call him out on comments like that because, you know, surely that's not any kind of official Hamas policy. That's just an Israeli version.
Well, why hasn't you got a Hamas spokesperson on at the same time as she's got the Israeli spokesperson on? You could ask that as well, couldn't you?
Yes.
Don't they have an opinion? Shouldn't we hear it?
You certainly could. Anyway, where do you think this particular conflict is heading here? Because it's not looking as if the Israelis are going to be, relaxing the controls that they have, the blockade on Gaza, anytime soon.
Well, it's quite possible.
Serious problems with access to water and things like that.
Well, it's quite possible that they're intending a final solution to all of this because Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon gave a speech last week where he said, well, we're expecting the Israelis to attack in Lebanon. There's also possibly going to be an attack on Iran, and in the middle of all of that, they then will try and push all the Gazans into Egypt. That's probably what they'll do.
There's also a big appeal.
But of course, they're not necessarily going to win
from
this bigger
some
war.
Israeli artists as well as all artists in Gaza saying boycott Eurovision.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the way to have a non-violent resolution of this is everybody puts on sanctions. We've got sanctions on Russia, we've got sanctions on China now, tariffs and all the rest of it. There's sanctions on also sanctions on Venezuela. What about sanctions on Israel? Because Israel basically is an artificial state. If it didn't have massive public subventions from US taxpayers and others, it wouldn't it would be a failed state. And of course they have a real problem that many people, Jews around the world, don't want to go and live in Israel because they can see that it's a bit of a mess.
So do you
and
think,
they'd rather not go than the Palestinians think, outnumber the Israelis.
So,
if we had a one state solution, and that's possible, then of course the Israelis would have to accept that
Martin,
they were the majority of the Palestinian
in this
state.
Week in the Guardian, minority, Ian Black has been suggesting Britain needs to recognise Palestine as an independent state.
Well, that's right. I think Jeremy Corbyn's already said that that's what we should do, and other countries like Ireland have already taken that step. But of course, the Israelis don't want that because they don't want a Palestinian state. They've pretty much made it clear they don't want one. And in that case, we then move away from having a two-state solution and we have a one-state solution. But of course, the Israeli state, the rump Israeli state, to my mind, has got to be where they agreed to be in 1948. Just as the Serbs can't control Kosovo, they can't control Palestine. And it's, the rules have got to be exactly the same for everybody, everywhere. And if one state like Israel completely flouts international law like that, it basically sets a precedent for everybody else to flout international law.
They're not flouting international law, they're reacting to rockets fired by Hamas.
No, they shouldn't be on that border in the first place. Yeah? And don't forget, if the Germans had invaded Britain in World War II, we'd have fired a few rockets at them. Of course we would.
Mike Pompeo, US Secretary of State, who's also a Christian Zionist, was in London this week chatting to Jeremy Hunt. And I must admit, I did have a little tiny little smile across my face as I heard Jeremy Hunt, because he sounds incredibly nervous, as if he might actually be a victim of imposter syndrome, being a little bit out of his depth. But anyway, here he is at the Foreign Office with the US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, our very own Jeremy Hunt, Foreign Secretary this week.
Today, the Prime Minister and I have had excellent discussions with Secretary Pompeo on a range of global challenges, including China and the situations in Yemen and Iran. Let me focus on two of those. First, Iran. The UK and US work incredibly closely on Iran, including to counter Iran's destabilising activity in the Middle East. Whilst we both agree that Iran must never be able to acquire a nuclear weapon, it's no secret that we have a different approach on how best to achieve that. The UK has continued to support the nuclear deal, which is a key achievement of the global non-proliferation architecture, because we believe it's in our shared security interests. But today's announcement from Tehran about its commitments under the deal is an unwelcome step. I urge Iran not to take further escalatory steps and to stand by its commitments. Sanctions were lifted in exchange for restrictions on Iran's nuclear program. Should Iran cease to observe its nuclear commitments, there would, of course, be consequences. For as long as Iran keeps its commitments, then so too will the United Kingdom.
Thank you, Foreign Secretary Hunt. This is my first trip to the United Kingdom as Secretary of State. But Jeremy and I have met many times at many different places in the world, and we talk frequently by phone. You've truly become a great friend, and I know that you're a great partner to our collective desire to keep our two countries safe. It was my privilege to meet with you and with Prime Minister May. President Trump is very much looking forward to his visit here next month and commemorating D-Day with our great allies. It was evident in my conversations both with Jeremy and with Prime Minister May that the special relationship doesn't simply endure. It's thriving, despite what you might read in the papers. And we're ready to meet new challenges and face them together and seize on new opportunities together as well. Brexit has obviously been a hot topic here. I reiterated to the Prime Minister as well as to Foreign Secretary Hunt that it's the United Kingdom's sovereign and democratic choice on how it will proceed, but also that no matter what happens, the United States will continue our strong relationship with both the United Kingdom and the EU. Our great hope is that Brexit can be resolved soon because President Trump is eager to strike a bilateral trade agreement that expands on our number one trade relationship. I've had the privilege as both CIA director and now as Secretary of State to observe how the UK has been amongst our most reliable partners on a broad range of security issues. We are grateful for your support of our diplomacy and pressure against North Korea, your eagerness to contribute to the strength of the NATO alliance, and your leadership to resolve crises in Syria and in Yemen. The United Kingdom also has contributed mightily to the coalition to defeat ISIS. And as the attacks in Sri Lanka showed, we need to keep up that fight against radical Islamic terrorism. a key part of that fight is that every coalition member must take back terrorist fighters captured on the battlefield.
Martin, this is a little bit cheeky of him talking about D-Day and everything, because we know this week we've had the anniversary of VE Day, and this is the end of the Second World War in Europe, which actually the Russians won. 27 million Russians died defeating Hitler. Would you like to have a stab and a guess at how many British died and how many Americans died in the Second World War, soldiers?
Less than a million.
In total, between the two of them, around about each the US and the British military casualties in World War II were both around 400,000 compared to the 27 million Russians. And yet,
more people were killed in bombing. Thing, that's just soldiers.
I was looking. Yeah, this is soldiers, of course. But I was looking at the BBC's coverage this week, and rather than have any sort of interest in the Russian parades going on in Moscow to celebrate the end of the Great Patriotic War. And their victory, and the 27 million Russian soldiers died.
Wasn't saying for soldiers, 27 million people. They lost millions of soldiers, but that's a lot of. They lost lots of civilian casualties as well.
Okay. So, yes, okay. I can just double check that. Is the actual number PQR for Russia? The Soviet Union. Okay, sorry. Soviet Union, 8.6 million.
That's the soldiers.
Yeah. Soldiers died, and so anyway, so the point here being that the BBC put out a piece about Stalin and how he's actually not really so popular in Russia, and he shouldn't be popular in Russia now. But actually, of course, Stalin was in charge of that, wasn't he? He was running the show over in Russia at the time.
Well, I mean, what's going on is, you know, Pompeo is lining Britain up for all of their adventures around the world. He didn't mention Russia there, but the British have been slavishly following the US line on Russia, and in fact possibly driving a more hostile line than the Americans themselves
let me just clear
want.
The numbers of figures of military casualties. Roughly 400,000 British died in World War II military. Roughly 400,000 American military personnel died.
That was
and roughly 10 million Russian personnel, military personnel died in World War II.
Yeah, well, also, of course, they lost 17 million civilians because they were invaded, unlike Britain or the United States. In fact, the United States didn't suffer any civilian casualties at all, to speak of.
What about all the other things Mike Pompeo is saying there? Fascinating, talking about, you know, stopping Iran's nuclear ambitions. Well, of course, Israel has, we know, at least 200 nuclear weapons.
Indeed. And, of course, the Iranians have... there was a deal that the Iranians basically haven't got nuclear weapons, as far as I can tell, and they don't particularly want them. But they don't want them not to have... Jeremy Hunt's being disingenuous there. The Americans want regime change in Tehran. They're not interested in doing deals with the Iranians. They made that absolutely clear. They're not interested in doing deals about nuclear weapons or anything. They just want regime change.
The Obama regime,
as revenge for the revolution of 79.
If we're allowed to call it the Obama regime, the Obama regime did want to have some sort of a deal. Obviously, Trump and Pompeo have thrown all that out. But actually, Iran is not America's enemy. Surely, it's Israel's enemy.
Well, because the Israelis have a stranglehold on US policy, that makes them America's enemy. Does it make it our enemy? That's what I'd say to Jeremy Hunt and Theresa May. The Israelis have made their position absolutely clear, and the Americans are making their position absolutely clear. They want to go to war with Iran this year. I would suggest that that's not the view of the ordinary people of Britain. We don't want a war with Iran, but the Conservative government is going to drag us into one. And if they do, we're going to eat them alive.
Or the ordinary people of the United States, either.
Well, the ordinary people of the United States are far more bamboozled by propaganda than we are. Most of them probably don't want a war, but many of them are rather ignorant. And, of course, the wars with the United States always happen somewhere else. Iran's much closer to us than that, and Iraq is much closer to us than the United States. There's the Atlantic Ocean in the way that prevents them from getting the blowback. But we're getting the blowback from all our previous interventions now, aren't we?
Jeremy Hunt there talked about Iran doing escalating tensions over the JCPOA. Surely this isn't really Iran. This is a reaction to the Americans and Trump pulling out of the nuclear agreement.
Yes, I mean, basically they're acting like complete bullies. I don't think the Iranians are very sensible to say, well, we're going to restart our nuclear program, because they don't
need
a nuclear.
What they've said is,
program.
Okay, let's just be absolutely clear. We will hear a bit more about this in a minute, what they're actually going to do, which is what they've said is, if you allow the U.S. US to bully and bamboozle you into having EU sanctions on Iran, we will just have to tear the agreement up.
Well, so, yes, if there's no agreement, there's no agreement.
We haven't torn the agreement up with you. We've torn it up with the the Americans have torn it up with us. So that if you don't stand up to the Americans and continue normal trade relations with Iran, we won't tear it up.
Well, in that case, there's no deal, then they're under no obligation. Well, don't forget the Iranians have signed the non-proliferation treaty. Who hasn't signed it? The Israelis.
Why are the EU not standing up to the Americans and saying, well, we will deal with Iran if we want to?
They've basically said that, but the Americans have said, no, if you do that, we are going to put sanctions on your companies. The companies have basically turned back to the governments and said, oh, we do quite a lot of business in America, we can't afford to annoy them. So in other words, the Americans, the great free marketeers, are saying, you can't do business with Iran, you can't do business with China, and if anybody, the Chinese, of course, buy a lot of their oil from Iran, and they're being told that they can't buy Iranian oil, otherwise there'll be further sanctions, blah and blah. Now, in actual fact, the Americans are basically behaving like complete bullies on the world stage. It's going to be interesting to see how far they get with all of this, because they're basically annoying everybody, but everybody is scared of them for obvious reasons, because they can hurt you. Well, they're big bullies, they've got nuclear weapons, they've got all sorts of ways to hurt you.
Jeremy Hunt certainly did sound a little bit nervous there, I have to say. Now, anyway, also, Mike Pompeo has been very critical of the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, particularly over Venezuela.
You said, for example, Jeremy Corbyn's position on Venezuela is disgusting. I mean, that's a strong word to use.
It's disgusting. I repeat that. This is a supporting individual, Maduro, who has for years systemically looted Venezuela and caused women to not be able to feed their babies and to provide medical care for their children. The medicine sits on their very border. The food sits on their very border. The European Union and American taxpayers were incredibly gracious.
So there just shouldn't be outside interference in Venezuela.
Yes, well, providing food to starving children isn't interference. It's support. It's what we do. It's in our deepest traditions of humanitarian assistance. The interference has taken place. The Cubans are there. They've interfered. So I hope Mr. Corbyn will ask the Cubans to cease their interference in Venezuela.
You've also just said that you believe anti-Zionism is the same as anti-Semitism. Now, there are many on the left who dispute that, who say that you can have reservations about Israel and particularly the behavior of the Israeli government and not be anti-Semitic.
Critiquing the policies of the government of Israel is completely in bounds. Calling for the destruction of Israel, seeking actions that will lead to its destruction, that's not acceptable. This is what I mean. It's not anti-Zionism to critique an Israeli policy set. It is anti-Zionism to take positions which ultimately undermine the democracy that exists there in Israel and the human rights of those Israeli
people.
Sounds
as if you were worried that the two are getting blurred.
They are, and we need to make sure that we're crystal clear about that.
Well, I think that's absolutely outrageous, really. There's been a blockade on Venezuela since Chavez came to power years ago. The British have actually, the Venezuelans said, can we have $1.5 billion of our gold back in the Bank of England? The Bank of England said, no, you can't have it. And there's been a report recently that showed that 40,000 Venezuelans have died because of the sanctions placed on them by the West and by the Americans in the last 2 years alone. And the poorest Venezuelans are the ones who are suffering the most, and they are the ones who support the Maduro regime. The people who want him out are the posh people from the posh suburbs of Caracas.
It's the Maduro government.
The Maduro government. Okay, let's call it the government then. And of course, Jeremy Hunt there, lining up against Jeremy Corbyn this guy Guaido that they're trying to impose on the Venezuelans. Most Venezuelans didn't know who he was when the Americans proclaimed him president of Venezuela. 80% of Venezuelans responded, well, who is he? Never heard of him. Now, in actual fact, Jeremy Corbyn's been a bit too mealy-mouthed about this. The attempt to overthrow the government of Venezuela by sanctions and by using violence, lots of people have been killed. You know, when people shoot police officers, if we went around shooting Israeli police officers, Palestinians went around shooting Israeli police officers, that would be called terrorism. When it's done inside Venezuela, it's part of the uprising of the people against the socialist dictatorship of Chavez, which has actually created loads and loads of positive features for the poorest Venezuelans, providing health care, and education
actually,
and things
in,
that they never had before Shabbos
back
came
in the 1940s, Israelis were shooting British policemen.
Well, indeed, they were, weren't they? So then that's not terrorism either, of course, because you're creating the state of Israel, and the people say that the state of Israel shouldn't exist. The state of Israel, was, as I said earlier, was recognised in certain boundaries in 1948. Certainly didn't include the Golan Heights, certainly didn't include Jerusalem, certainly didn't include the land contiguous to Gaza. Now, when the Serbs, as I said earlier, when the Serbs tried to aggress others in Yugoslavia when I was an aid worker, we went to war with them. That's what we should be talking about doing with the Israelis.
Mike Pompeo's got some pretty strong views on these Iranian nukes as well. That's what he's worried about, development of nuclear weapons over in Iran. He's very worried.
We need real IAEA inspections. We have to have IAEA inspections of military sites. This reluctance to offend the Iranians and come up with a conclusion of noncompliance, this has to stop. I might add that when word of the Israelis acquiring the nuclear archive documents got around in early 2018, the Iranians started to empty out this warehouse in Tehran. Now, the IAEA was informed of this by the Israelis, and as I said, they didn't bother to inspect it until April of 2019. And I imagine a lot of the evidence was gone by then. This is just unacceptable. We have to have serious inspections. I'd like to see any place, anytime inspections in Iran. There were Obama officials talked about that. I know the Iranians aren't crazy about that. But look, the Iranians have to win the confidence of the world after repeatedly violating their nuclear obligations over decades.
Well, the IAEA have said that they've not, they've basically stuck to the deal 100%. So Pompeo's just talking complete nonsense there. The Iranians have satisfied the IAEA that they've fulfilled all the conditions that were placed on them. Now, of course, if they're going to rip the deal up, then there's no deal. And of course, when are the Israelis going to allow random inspections by Russians, for example, to see whether they've got any nuclear weapons? They're not supposed to have any at all. And under the Logan Act in the US, any country that develops nuclear weapons without permission has to have sanctions on it. Sanctions on Israel for having nuclear weapons. And of course, the only reason the Iranians would want nuclear weapons is because the Israelis have got them. So if you want to stop the Iranians having nuclear weapons, denuclearise Israel.
Anyway, from time to time, the BBC do a fantastic job on Iran, and they did this week. I think it was on Wednesday morning on World Update. There was one of the professors from Tehran University they had on to explain to the world and to us, for a change, you never see this on the TV at all, exactly what the Iranians, why the Iranians have decided that they may be resuming uranium enrichment. And so let's have a listen to that in full now.
How concrete is the threat that Iran
the BBC's
will increase
Dan Damon
its
speaking.
Uranium enrichment programme? I put that question to Sayed Mohammed Marandi from the University of Tehran.
The Iranians are very serious, especially because the United States has been gradually pulling out of the nuclear deal for 2 years now. And last year, they pulled out completely. And ever since then, European countries have, despite their positive language, but in reality, they have been complying by Trump's demands. And the Iranians are saying that this cannot continue. We cannot have a one-sided deal where the Iranians abide by all their commitments and the other side abides by none.
The problem is the Europeans are in a bind because the global banking system on which they and everyone relies is controlled through the United States. And so any transaction that any European country wants to do is blocked if they do deals with Iran.
Well, the Iranians don't accept that argument. The Europeans have more than enough leverage to stop the United States from bullying them. And collectively with the Russians and the Chinese, they can make sure that the Americans do not interfere in their commitment to the nuclear deal. If the Europeans cannot protect their citizens, if they cannot protect their businesses, if they cannot protect their interests and their banks, then they really shouldn't be at any negotiating table. But in any case, if the Europeans don't begin implementing the nuclear deal, the Iranians will gradually have to move in a different direction. This cannot continue a one-sided deal where the Americans try to strangle the Iranian economy, where the Americans try to make ordinary Iranians suffer, where they try to prevent Iran from using banks, exporting oil, importing medicine, and also block Iran's peaceful nuclear program. This simply cannot continue. So it's for the Europeans to decide if they're going to be a part of the solution or if they're going to be a part of the problem.
And how concerned is the Iranian government that the rhetoric from the United States and indeed the deployment of a carrier strike group, including B-52 bombers, suggests that there is at least part of the U.S. administration that would like to attack Iran or at least severely restrict their operations around the Middle East?
I mean, let me be blunt. Iran does not want war. But if the Americans know quite well that if there is war, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz will be a sideshow. All oil and gas installations in the Persian Gulf will be destroyed. The Americans will be driven out of Iraq and Afghanistan. This will have implications that are beyond anything that I'd like to think about. It would change, it would create a global economic catastrophe, a severe global depression, and the Americans will be to blame. So I think the Iranians are calculating that sane people in the U.S. government, in the military, and in the CIA will be able to contain the likes of Bolton and Pompeo. But at the end of the day, it's up to the United States. The Iranians do not want conflict, but the Persian Gulf region is not a region where the Americans can keep the oil flowing and bomb Iran at the same time. It will just not happen.
But the U.S. says that it's Iran's actions in Yemen, stirring up trouble with Hezbollah in Lebanon against Israel. Even the recent rocket attacks by Hamas are laid by some Americans at the feet of the Iranians, and then stirring up trouble in Baghdad or increasing their influence in Iraq. That is the reason for the ratcheting up of the tension, isn't it?
Iraq has a democratically elected government that wants very good relations with Iran. You can't blame Iran for that. In Syria, it's now well documented the support that the United States and Saudi Arabia, among others, gave to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency document of 2012, among many other documents, it's quite clear that these countries were supporting extremists, and if it wasn't for Iran, we would have black flags flying over Damascus and Baghdad today. In Yemen, it's the U.S. that's carrying out starvation with the Saudis. And in Gaza, the people are under siege for years. I don't think that the United States can blame Iran for the crimes that it is committing in this region.
Said Mohammed Marandi from the University of Tehran.
Well, isn't that a bit of fresh air to hear the Iranian point of view being put? And how ridiculous to hear Jeremy Hunt basically going along with all of this nonsense from Pompeo. Basically, there's a real danger that there's going to be a Middle East war because of the intransigence of the Israelis and the Americans, and Britain is implicated empowering these bullies.
The U.S. carrier strike group is now within 2,000 kilometres of Iran. We hear today, Martin, it's just been gone through this CENTCOM carrier group has just gone through the Suez Canal.
Yes, and the Egyptians have allowed them through. I suppose they've got to allow them through, but then, of course, they're responsible for the consequences. And they're going to get into the Persian Gulf. I think the idea of sending an aircraft carrier into the Persian Gulf is absolutely bonkers. They should have sent, I was thinking about this when I read this the other day, they should have sent it the other way round to come through the Indian Ocean so that they can fly attacks on Iran from the Indian Ocean, Diego Garcia, somewhere like that. Basically an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf is just going to get sunk in the first 10 minutes of the battle, and everybody on it is going to be drowned.
So this is something called the USS Abraham Lincoln-led strike group. There's also deploying 52 strategic bombers. Oh, sorry, no, no B-52.
And they've been sent to Qatar, which is very interesting because the Qataris do not want a war with Iran. The Iranians and the Qataris actually made up when the Saudis were blockading Qatar, and therefore they're having they don't want these bombers there. And of course, that could lead to a situation where they're attacked on the ground.
The U.S. ambassador to Russia, John Huntsman, has called the deployment a 100,000-ton message to Russia.
To Russia? Well, I'll tell you what's going to happen if there's a war in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf. The Russians are going to stand back and watch the Iranians basically destroy the US. They haven't got a military... They've got no military sense at all. you attack a country like Iran, the Persian Gulf is a death trap. It's an absolute death trap. Military personnel, including British military personnel, are going to be in this base in Bahrain. They're never going to come out of there alive. They're all going to die.
There's a whole load of, I suppose, headlines around this as well. Top US officials, Martin, a meeting on a possible attack on Iran today. US officials continue to falsely accuse Iran of planning an attack. And Iran is calling for strengthening the nuclear deal. In the EU is rejecting their ultimatum. The US commander says he could send the carrier into the Strait of Hormuz.
And what will happen to it? It'll get sunk. It'll just get sunk. They'll fire missiles at it from the land. They're not going to fight an air-sea battle with them. They're just going to sink their aircraft carrier with everybody on board.
In the meantime, Putin has been doing something quite interesting, I see, this week. And this has happened very quickly, just over the last 2 months or so. And I do wonder, actually, whether the Russians play quite a clever PR game. This is about the Russia creating its own internet. And mm-hmm. It seems to me that these things get developed, they get announced, and very quickly, actually, they are ready and rolled out and ready to happen, rather than the years and years it seems to take our leaders to actually get anything to happen. So we heard I think it's in February, Russia must build its own internet in case of foreign disruption from Putin. And this week they've announced it's ready to go. They've got their own internet. So in other words, that the various indexes which are used to control whereabouts you can, whether you can find websites or not on the internet, which are controlled by the US at the moment, are now that Russia's got their own version of this.
Well, basically, the leadership in Russia, the leadership in Iran, and the leadership in China would not be doing their job if they weren't preparing for war with the United States and the United Kingdom. And we, like fools, are marching towards this Armageddon. But of course, those who lead us into it, and we're definitely going to lose if we start a war with these people, well, I don't see that the Russians and the Chinese will directly involve in a fight between the Iranians and the West. They'll sit back and watch the Iranians do the dirty work. Well, and then they will
actually
wait to intervene when it's over.
Quite close to home, isn't it? Because on the nationalinterest.org blog in the US, we had a former Labour councillor from Stroud on a few weeks ago, talking about the B-52 bombers at Fairford.
Yeah.
And we now know that what they were practicing was a nuclear strike on Moscow. The US Air Force in early March 2019 deployed 5 B-52 bombers from Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana to Fairford in the United Kingdom. Some of the 8 engine long-range planes threw mock nuclear attacks on Russian soil. From Gloucestershire,
but of course the Russians have made their position absolutely clear. Any nuclear attack on us will lead to an overwhelming response, which will wipe you out. They're not playing the game of we're going to use little nukes. They're actually planning to use nuclear weapons on Iran, little ones, yeah, minor ones, and they're hoping that the Russians will then take the view. I think the Russian Putin's already said any use of nuclear weapons will lead to an all-out attack by us on you. I mean, do you remember we had the Westminster Abbey service for British nuclear weapons? Thank God for Russian nuclear weapons, eh?
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Now, you talked about the breath of fresh air from Tehran University. Also, Martin, Mohammad Javad Zarif, he's the Iranian foreign minister, speaks superb English, but we never hear anything from him either, do we?
But I presume we are now.
To my knowledge, and I've dealt with the UN for the last 40 years, this is the first time that this is happening at the UN, that a permanent member of the Security Council is openly calling on other countries to violate a Security Council resolution and threatening them with punishment if they didn't. So I think it's not for Iran to make that decision. It's for the rest of the international community to make a decision whether they want to allow this to happen or whether they want to stop somewhere. Now, we know that the United States is a big economic power. We know that the United States is a huge market. We know that nobody wants to lose the U.S. market. But the American government should understand that people are doing this out of desperation because they have no other choice. This is coercion, pure and simple. Do we want to build international relations on coercion? Do you think it's sustainable? These are important questions for anybody who's interested in long-term peace and stability in the world to ask if coercion is sustainable. As a diplomat who has devoted my life, and I know that you have to, we cannot accept that coercion is sustainable. We cannot accept that coercion should be the rule of the game. We're not idealists. We know that power play is a fact of life in international relations. But power has to be moderated by some sort of rules. Otherwise, we'll be living in a jungle. I do not want to repeat and bring you back to history. We had an empire ruling the world for much longer than the US has ever existed. And it ends. Empires end. We need to know whether we want to establish a modus operandi that would last longer than our empire.
So that was the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Jarad Zarif, Martin, really talking about what we were talking about earlier, which is the bullying and coercion going on right now by the US.
Well, Pompeo, when he'd been to Britain, or before he went to Britain, he went to Iraq and said, you've got to stop buying Iranian oil. And they politely told him to get lost. Because, of course, they're Shia. They're a Shia government, Arab Shia. And they are basically quite friendly with the Iranians.
This is all a little bit similar,
why shouldn't they be? They're their neighbours.
The run-up to the illegal invasion of Iraq with the weapons of mass destruction, with Mike Pompeo calling for inspections of Iran. Also, I mean, it's just there's so much, it seems, that this is... I mean, also, he, as a foreign minister, is a little bit like Iraq's Tariq Aziz, I think he was, who we're hearing very reasonable, sensible and very good English, but we're not actually hearing it anywhere on our mass media here.
No, but I think the Iranians are even in a stronger position because Iran's a much bigger country than Iraq with more people, and they do have a democratic system, unlike our allies in Saudi Arabia, who are raping Yemen as we speak and killing thousands with British missiles and British military personnel involved. Now, what I would say to British military personnel who are involved in any of this, you are a military personnel, and if we go to war, you're a legitimate target. And if I was an Iranian Revolutionary Guard or a Houthi volunteer, I'd be definitely trying to kill you, and I'd be within my rights to do so.
Talking about light at the end of the tunnel, because this is a bit grim, talking about this potential third world war the US State Department seems to be trying to cook up along with the Israelis over in the Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf, is the fact that Trump, Martin, today has been blaming John Bolton. He's saying that the quagmire that's been created in Venezuela is your fault, Bolton. Of course, they never blame themselves, do they?
Well, what's happened is Bolton promised Trump that he'd got the Venezuelan army on side and soon there was going to be a coup. But what it seems has happened is the Venezuelan generals picked up the phones to that they were being approached by the Americans. They went, yes, 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 we're going to change sides. Yes, of course we are. And then when they phoned them up on the morning that they were going to change sides, all their phones were switched off because, in fact, they didn't change sides. They were just playing a game. And, of course, the Venezuelan army is not going to change sides. And if they invade Venezuela, that's going to be like Iraq. They'll get in fine, but the Venezuelan army are preparing for a guerrilla war on the ground inside Venezuela if the Americans
are
foolish
enough to come and fight. Also, some good news. Chelsea Manning's been released from jail, just as Julian Assange has been locked up, bizarrely.
Has she been released?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that was news to me. I thought they were putting loads of pressure on her to try and put pressure on Assange, but that's a bit of good news if she has been released.
And also, we were here now from... We heard from Daniela Ganser last week, the Swiss academic from Basel University and historian, written a lot about secret warfare and secret armies. And in the second part, we're going to listen now to his thoughts about reform of the United Nations and why it's not working right now.
And I think as a human family today, you know, we should think of whether we want World War III or whether we don't want it. You know, everybody has to decide for himself, because the future is nothing which is now fixed or which, you know, is determined. This is something which depends on all of us, and it depends on what we want. And from many, many conversations that I had with many, many people in many, many countries, I can tell you as a fact that most people want peace. They don't want war. So it's something like we should be able to do it. If many, many people want it, I'm saying 90%, okay? I'm saying 90% of global population in all countries across all classes want peace, because they don't want to see their kids shot. They don't want to walk on a landmine. They don't want to live in a house which is being bombed, okay? They just don't want it. So we have an overwhelming, really overwhelming will for peace. At the same time, we see that United Nations don't really work. And what can we do right now? I think the best that we can do is to have a strong Secretary General. That'd be something very good. Kofi Annan, for instance, was a rather strong Secretary General. Ban Ki-moon was not very strong. And if I think back to Kofi Annan, you know, he came up on television and said that the war against Iraq was illegal. So he's basically the face telling the story. Because today you always have a face, okay? The United States is Trump, Russia is Putin, and Germany is Merkel. Obviously that's not true. I mean, not everybody in Germany looks like Merkel, and not everybody in the US agrees with Trump, or not everybody in Russia agrees with Putin. So, you know, this is a very strong simplification that we do in international politics. But the UN is the General Secretary. And it would be very good, I think, that every time that a war breaks out, for instance, 2011, the war against Libya, or 2001, the war against Afghanistan, or 2003, the war against Iraq, you know, many wars breaking out all the time, that the Secretary General goes in front of a global TV audience and says, let's not forget, ladies and gentlemen, that the UN Charter has declared that all wars are illegal. And so is this war. It is illegal. I call upon all nations to refrain from using military action. I think he could do it. I think he could do it. Unfortunately, he very often doesn't do it. And when he does it, like Kofi Annan, I looked at the data very clearly, he does it rather late, okay? The attack from the British and the Americans on Iraq came in 2003, and Kofi Annan addressed the global media in 2004. So he had like 1 year of delay. I mean, that's a lot of delay. He was right in the substance. He said this war is illegal, and people listened to him. I mean, people are much more inclined to believe what the General Secretary says than what a president or prime minister says. They know, you know, that these people are out for power and money and greed. But they think that the Secretary General represents, in many ways, the hopes for a better future, for more peace, for more justice. And so my suggestion would be that whenever a war breaks out, the Secretary General should step in front of the camera the same day, okay? The same day. And then you had television stations and newspapers and alternative media reporting the statement from the Secretary General, and he could always say wars are illegal, because that's in the UN Charter. You know, he doesn't need to come up with a new text. Students have asked me, okay, clever idea. Why doesn't he do it? And the answer is, he's being given his job not just by the world population, but by the five members of the Security Council. And they are the US, Russia, China, the British, and the French. So if these five attack another country, and just imagine, you know, you're the Secretary General, and you go like, this war is illegal. Then you've just criticized your boss. You're going to be fired. And so this is a dilemma that we have.
That's the Swiss author, historian from Basel University, Daniel Ganser, Martin, making a pretty clear case there, saying that actually, in fact, what he's saying effectively is that a lot of this is a media war. This is a propaganda war, and the UN Secretary General has got to up his game. Antonio Guterres, what's he been up to in the last week? Mm-hmm. Well, he's saying we've got to stop coal-fired power stations.
Yeah, well, the UN obviously is a flawed instrument because the Security Council is split over things like sanctions on Iran. It's quite clear that the Russians and the Chinese aren't happy with that.
You've missed the point completely. He's saying that there are rules in the UN and the Secretary-General should be more bold about saying, no, you can't have illegal wars.
Yeah, but
he should be on the TV straight away.
Yes, but he said at the end, if he did that, he'd be sacked straight away.
Well, maybe he would, but then at least he would have made an attempt.
Kofi Annan, as a former UN head, said the war on Iraq was illegal. It was illegal.
A year after the event. This is what his point is, a very good point, I think, which is really talking about the 80% of military spending which goes on psychological warfare. The UN have got to catch up.
Well, they have, but of course...
Anyway, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8 now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was Kai Dudd, and thanks to Martin Summers there. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Dialects here on Tuesday at noon, but do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics on today's show.
But the basic idea of a republic is that it should generate consensus, and it should generate, ideally, something like a supermajority for every policy that it pursues. And the reason for that is republics are designed to be more deliberative than democracies.
Today we begin a three-part series called Ancient Rome, From Republic to Empire, in which we explore the nature of the Roman Republic, compare and contrast it to our own, and also look at how it devolved into an empire.
The victory over Carthage, it helps generate an economic revolution that creates tremendous and very rapidly advancing wealth inequality in Rome. And so the weird legacy of the Second Punic War is Roman society that is simultaneously both more wealthy and also in some ways less stable.
We begin our three-part series with historian Edward J. Watts, author of the book Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Two Reuters journalists who were imprisoned after reporting on a military massacre of Rohingya Muslims were freed today as part of a mass presidential pardon in Myanmar, while Lone and Cha Soo-oo walked out of Yangon's notorious insane prison. While Lone praised those at home and abroad who had kept up the pressure for their release for more than 500 days in prison.
Inside in the prison and also around the world, people who are wishing to release us. So I would like to say thank you very much for everything. I'm really happy and excited to see my family and my colleagues.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to go my newsroom.
Wallone said, I can't wait to go to my newsroom. The two reporters were arrested in December of 2017 as they were working on a story about security forces involved in killing Rohingya Muslims. The case drew global attention, not only as a media freedom issue, but also as an example of how democratic reforms in Myanmar have stalled under Nobel Peace Laureate Aung San Suu Kyi's civilian government. The United Nations Human Rights Office welcomed their release, but said the two journalists never should have been arrested in the first place. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is declaring case closed on the Russia probe and potential obstruction by President Trump. They were his most significant public comments yet on the Mueller investigation. He accused Democrats of not being serious in the wake of the publication of the report by special counsel Robert Mueller.
What we've seen is a meltdown, an absolute meltdown, an inability to accept the bottom line conclusion on Russian interference from the special counsel's report, which said The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. That's the conclusion. Case closed. Case closed.
Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called McConnell's statement an astounding bit of whitewashing.
He doesn't want to move on. He wants to run away from these awful facts that relate to the wellspring of our democracy, foreign interference in our election, and a president who is lawless.
Schumer challenged McConnell to move legislation that would improve election security and be tougher on Russian sanctions. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi also responded to McConnell, saying, "That's just not a fact. The case is not closed." Tomorrow, House Democrats are set to meet with Attorney General William Barr as they negotiate to see a full unredacted Mueller report. The House Judiciary Committee is poised to vote to hold Barr in contempt of Congress for the Justice Department's failure to comply with a subpoena to turn over the unredacted report and its underlying documents. More than 600 former federal prosecutors have signed on to a letter saying President Trump would have been charged with obstruction of justice if he were anyone other than the president. The letter was signed by former Justice Department prosecutors who served under both Democratic and Republican administrations. The White House is instructing former counsel Don McGahn not to comply with a subpoena for documents from the House Judiciary Committee. The current White House counsel says the materials are subject to executive privilege. The Judiciary Committee has requested information about McGahn's interactions with President Trump that were documented in the Mueller report. Georgia Republican Governor Brian Kemp has signed legislation banning abortions once a fetal heartbeat can be detected. That can be as early as 6 weeks before many women know they're pregnant.
We stand up and speak for those unable to speak for themselves. The Life Act is very simple, but also very powerful. A declaration that all life has value, that all life matters, and that all life is worthy of protection.
Several states have passed fetal heartbeat bills, hoping to use the legislation as a vehicle to win a rollback in abortion rights at the U.S. Supreme Court. The ACLU of Georgia said the group would challenge Georgia's new abortion restrictions in court. I'm Eileen Alfandary. Letters and Politics is next.
Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. In reading the notes from the debates at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, 1787, and I say notes because the convention itself was not open to the public, one might think what the Constitution's framers were arguing about was ancient Rome. They were basing their arguments and theories over the formation of a new government off the old Roman Republic that existed between 280 BC and 44 BC, a period of some 236 years. The United States Republic itself is 242 years, just to give a little perspective. Now, if one reads the Federalist and Anti-Federalist papers that were for and against ratifying the U.S. Constitution, figures you'll see like James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and George Mason never signed their writings with their actual names, but with pen names, frequently from ancient Rome, such as Cicero, Cato, and Brutus. Now, the framers of the Constitution, however, were not just trying to replicate the political systems of the ancient worlds, but to build off of them and improve them in a way that would keep a republic from dissolving into chaos, because that's exactly what happened to the Roman Republic, eventually leading to the rise of a strong-armed emperor and an empire that would persist in one way or another for an additional 1,500 years. So with that in mind, today we begin a three-part series that we are calling Ancient Rome, From Republic to Empire. Today and tomorrow we're joined by historian Edward Watts for a conversation on how the Republic worked and how it came apart. On Thursday we'll be joined by another classicist, Barry Strauss, about Rome's transformation into an empire. But we begin with the Republic. Edward J. Watts holds the Alcibiades Vassilides Endowed Chair and also Professor of History at the University of California, San Diego. He is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. Edward Watts, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio station.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here.
Today we're really going to focus on how the ancient Roman Republic worked, how it operated, its different parts, and the conditions that would lead to the fall. And then tomorrow we're actually going to dive in to how it did come apart. So let's begin by talking about what a republic even is. The United States is considered a republic. Ancient Rome was considered a republic. Many countries today have republic as part of their name. So how do you define a republic?
Yeah, I think that the most important thing for everyone to understand in a modern context is a republic is a representative democracy. And what that means in a big picture way is that it's different from a pure democracy. It's different from, say, the Athenian democracy of the 5th century BC, where every citizen who had a vote would get together, they would vote, and a simple majority would decide how the state would respond to a particular situation or what policies it would implement. And in a republic, the system works differently. What individual citizens do is they elect representatives who collectively serve to represent the voice of the people for a specific amount of time. And then when that time is up, there is another election and more representatives are chosen, or potentially the same people are brought back to serve as representatives again. But the basic idea of a republic is that it should generate consensus, and it should generate, ideally, something like a supermajority for every policy that it pursues. And the reason for that is republics are designed to be more deliberative than democracies. When you look at a pure democracy, what you see is the decisions are made quickly, but the state is incredibly dynamic. And so it can make decisions and then reverse those decisions very, very quickly, almost a sort of whiplash-inducing politics. And a republic is designed to move more slowly so that the decisions that are made generate very broad support. And the state can move forward without continually going back and revising positions and policies that it has set up. And so the basic idea in a republic is that the society prefers to move slowly to make decisions, and it also prefers to make no decision instead of making a decision that has a very narrow base of support. And when a republic is functioning well, it generates consensus and compromise and builds progressively towards policies that the entire society more or less endorses, or at least as close to the entire society as you can reasonably get. And so what that means is these societies are not as dynamic as pure democracies, but the policies and decisions they make tend to be more binding and people feel more invested in them. And so a republic prizes stability over dynamism to a degree.
It can also be frustrating, right? Because things can change slowly.
Yeah, and that's the big problem that you face in a republic like Rome, or even a republic like the United States now. When society is changing very quickly, a republic doesn't move as fast as society can change, because it needs to build a consensus behind the policies that it wants to enact. And when it does enact those policies, these policies tend to be broadly supported. I think a good example of that is something like Social Security, where there was a broad base of support for Social Security when it was implemented, and that policy has remained in place for over 80 years because of that. Obamacare was not put in place with such a strong mandate that covered so much of the political spectrum, and therefore it's less stable. There's more willingness and perhaps desire to try to reverse that policy because it wasn't put in place with a consensus backing it. And the challenge in a republic is when society is developing quickly, when, for example, new technology is creating mechanisms to generate wealth much more quickly than normal, there are stresses in the society that a republic really struggles to respond to, because the citizens of that republic expect a problem to be dealt with much faster than the republic is sometimes capable of doing. A consensus solution to something like wealth inequality is very difficult to find. And citizens can tend to get frustrated in the time it takes a republic to reach that kind of solution.
Looking at the Roman Republic, and there was a Roman civilization, a Roman society before the republic would begin. Rome did have kings previously. When do you say the Roman Republic began. Is 280 BC about right?
So there are different phases of the Roman Republic. I think what's important, and I think it's sometimes amazing for us in a modern context to think about, is the Roman state actually survives for about 2,200 years.
Yeah.
It starts as a monarchy in around 750 BC, and it ends as an empire that's captured by the Ottomans using cannons and gunpowder in 1453 AD. And in between, there are many phases of political development in Rome. But the first phase is this monarchy. And then around 509 BC, the monarchy is overthrown and the republic is set up. The republic is a dynamic, it's a dynamic enterprise and a dynamic institution that evolves progressively over time to become more inclusive and more responsive. But by the time you get into the 280s BC, the republic has taken the form that it will more or less maintain for 200 odd years. It will be more or less as it was in the 280s until it collapses into the dictatorship and the tyranny of Augustus.
Tell me the story about what happens in 280 BC. It seems like this is a foundational story on the Republic itself. Tell me the story about Pyrrhus, Appius Claudius, and Gaius Fabricius Lucinus.
So this is an incredible story. Pyrrhus of Epirus is a descendant of Alexander the Great. He's a relative of Alexander the Great. And Rome, in the period when Alexander's empire is dissolving, Rome manages to achieve domination of nearly the entire Italian peninsula. And around 280 BC, Rome comes into conflict with the city of Tarentum in southern Italy. And the city of Tarentum is actually quite alarmed because Rome is large, it's powerful, and Tarentum by itself can't really confront Rome. And so it invites in Pyrrhus of Epirus, and he comes with a professional army, he comes with elephants, and he begins fighting the Romans. And the Romans have a citizen army, basically draftees. They are not professional soldiers. And Pyrrhus inflicts a really significant defeat on the Romans. But the Romans fight hard. And the Romans, even though they've never confronted an elephant before, they hold their grounds and they inflict losses on Pyrrhus that are difficult for him to take. And so what Pyrrhus does is he offers very generous peace terms to the Romans. In effect, the Romans have to admit that Pyrrhus has beaten them, but there's not much else that they have to grant to Pyrrhus other than a return to the status quo before Pyrrhus arrived. And the Roman Senate thinks about this and many people in the Senate think this is a good deal. You know, they have lost the battle. They don't really know how to fight elephants. And the general trend in the Senate is to approve this and have Pyrrhus go away. And then Appius Claudius, who is an old, grizzled, well-established Roman politician, comes into the Senate. He's crippled. It's very difficult for him to move. And he makes a speech where he says to Romans, if you don't stand your ground and you don't stand up to Pyrrhus, everyone else in Italy will take note of the fact that you were defeated and your domination of Italy will be threatened. And that's going to mean that Rome has to assume certain costs. That's going to mean that Rome is going to have to commit to fighting this war. But for us to be safe as a society, we have to be willing to assume those costs. And if we don't, we should very well understand that we are going to be threatened and our people who are adversaries are not going to take us seriously. And the Roman Senate decides to continue pursuing the war with Pyrrhus. The situation with Fabricius involves Pyrrhus summoning another member of the Roman Senate and trying to bribe him and use the bribery to try to induce Rome to come to some sort of an agreement that, again, will preserve Pyrrhus's forces. And what Fabricius says is, in some ways, the personal corollary to the social argument that Appius Claudius made. What Fabricius says is what makes me valuable in my society is my achievements in the Republic and in the service to the Republic. And if I am to take your bribes or I'm willing to take your wealth, that undermines everything that I've achieved in my life, and it undermines everything that my family in previous generations have also achieved.
And the story of Fabricius is very important because what it demonstrates is this ideal of the highest honor someone could have is loyalty to the republic itself, even though, and that's what he chooses, say, over all the gold and silver that Pyrrhus is offering him.
Yeah, and that's the value that Romans felt all Romans should hold forth as the thing that guides their conduct. Service to Rome should come before wealth. It should come before honors. It should come before anything else that a person might decide to pursue in a public way. The great success of the early republic and the republic through even the middle decades of the 3rd century BC is that the thing that's most valuable to Romans, to elite Romans who are serving and commanding in Rome, is a quality that the republic has a monopoly on. You know, the idea of honor and recognition in the terms that Rome sets, the republic sets those terms. And anything that you might aspire to accomplish as someone who is important or wealthy or from an old family, the republic decides whether you succeed or fail in accomplishing that. And so that monopoly on what's valuable to Romans provides a really strong check on the kinds of behavior that Romans will undertake in that period.
This is a period of time that's also known that we see what's called the conflict of orders. What was that?
So that's a really interesting, and I find for my students, a really challenging thing to think about. In Roman society, when the Republic is set up, political power was restricted to people who belonged to a set of aristocratic families, and these are called the patricians. Now, this was a set of aristocratic families that was determined purely by birth. And so in the main, patricians were on the average richer than non-patricians, which Romans called plebeians. But your membership in this particular order wasn't determined by your wealth. And there were a lot of plebeians who were wealthier than many patricians, but they couldn't become patricians. And the conflict of the orders is, in a sense, a conflict between the wealthy and powerful plebeians who cannot get political power in the state because people who belong to a hereditary aristocracy are monopolizing it. And when the Republic is set up in 509 BC, political power is almost exclusively allocated to patricians on the basis of their birth and the family they came from. And over the course of those 200 years, what we see is a chipping away so that influential and wealthy plebeians get an increasing share and increasing access to positions of power in the Republic. But what's challenging for us is the patrician plebeian divide is not a class divide. Mm. It's a divide of orders, of social structures based on heredity, not wealth. And for us in a modern context, that's very hard to get our minds around. But what we see there is there are really two types of power in the Roman Republic, in the early Roman Republic. There's hereditary power, and then there's economic and social power. And the conflict of the orders is an attempt to preserve some of the prerogatives of hereditary power while also accommodating the power that belongs to people who have wealth or social capital, but don't have descent from an aristocratic family.
If one looks at history, not so unusual to have that dynamic. I think if we look at the formation of even before this period of Greek democracy, that was the issue, is you had this hereditary power and then the wealthy and the people who were successful in business and saying, we want a slice of the pie. We want to be able to govern as well. And that's how you start to get the formation of democracy, I guess, with the reforms from Solon. If you even look at, say, the French Revolution or even the American Revolution, it could be argued that these were actually revolutions based on the aristocrats wanting some power as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the interesting thing is a republic particularly lends itself to that type of conversation. In Greece, when you get a democracy, what's interesting about that is that the power actually isn't confined to people who are economically prosperous or possess some sort of social capital. It's actually a purely majority system in which regular people's vote actually matters quite a bit. But in a republic, the system is in a way stacked so that the votes of certain people matter more than the votes of other people. And we, of course, see this in the United States, where in a presidential election, our vote in California matters something like 1/60th of the vote for somebody in Wyoming. It's designed. It's not a flaw in the system. It's a design of the system. And when you have a system where people with economic and social capital are trying to find a place in a system that has traditionally rewarded aristocratic families, they don't actually want to share whatever power they're able to accumulate with regular people who don't have wealth or social capital. And a republic is particularly well designed to give those wealthy people more of a voice than the people who don't have that wealth. And in the United States, of course, we see that when the initial right to vote is confined to property holders. This was, of course, not a flaw, but a design. And it was very deliberately put in place so that the prerogatives of governance would be confined to a certain level of society, and people without a certain level of wealth didn't have the ability to participate fully.
This is Letters on Politics, and we are in conversation about the ancient Roman Republic, a republic that was in part used as a model and as a warning in the creation of the United States Constitution. Our guest is Edward Watts. He holds the Akaviadis Visialadis Endowed Chair and Professor of History at the University of California, San Diego. He is the author of the book Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. My friends, today is the first day of our spring fun drive for KPFA in Berkeley, where I broadcast from. And also in their fun drive is our sister station, KPFK, in Los Angeles. For this fun drive, we are doing something different this time. We are diving into a single story for the entire week, each week during this fun drive, to really take time and get into it, to take several hours with whoever we are talking to get at the heart of their life work. Now, this week, it's the story of ancient Rome from republic to empire. Next week, it is the history of socialism. For us, when we ask you for your financial support during our fun drive, we believe that's the time we should be bringing you our best work, work that we hope is special, doing something a little bit different. Now, just after today's show, I will be sitting down for 3 hours with preeminent Civil War historian Eric Foner to talk about the political history from the 1850s to the 1890s. This is a really intense period, of course, includes the Civil War, but the decade before the Civil War, in some ways, will very much remind you of the moment that we are living through right now. And then the period after the Civil War, especially when you look at what happened legally, constitutionally, the things that we took major steps backwards and then forward and then back again, you could see how it would create the modern world that we're living in today. So that will be coming up later on in the fun drive. And my friends, for this to be able to work, for us to be able to do this kind of work, we are going to need your support. And that support means and includes a financial contribution of what you can afford, what's reasonable for you, what you think we are deserving of, and what you will feel good about knowing that you did your part in supporting public broadcasting and supporting a radio program that I hope our goal, and I hope it's obvious, is to try to bring a sense of education back to the airwaves, which we think is very important and which is, for us, I think on this radio program, our driving mission. $25 pledge makes you a basic member to this radio station. We're going to have to average about $100 per pledge if we are going to make our goal today in order for us to be able to do this kind of broadcasting. But of course, that's one person pledging $25, and that's another person pledging $175. That's a number of people pledging $25, and perhaps another individual who has access to deeper means pledging $200, $500, even $1,000. The telephone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And online at kpfa.org. Or if you're in Southern California, kpfk.org. Also, if you want to make that contribution for Los Angeles, that phone number is... There are two different phone numbers. I forgot to put this out there. I'm so wrapped up in trying to explain what we're trying to do here. There's two phone numbers for the Bay Area and Northern California, KPFA. That number is 1-800-439-5732. And for Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735. So that's 818-985-5735 if you're listening in Los Angeles or to KPFK. You could also donate at kpfk.org. And in Northern California, you can donate to KPFA by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org. Sorry for that confusion there. I'll give those numbers again right before we go back to the interview. If you are interested in thank you gifts, we do have four of them. And let me tell you about them quickly. For a pledge of $75, we will send you on a CD our entire three-hour special this week on ancient Rome from Republic to Empire. So today we're talking about the nature of a republic, how the ancient Roman Republic worked, and how it's sort of like how it compares and contrasts to our own. Tomorrow we're going to talk about how it devolved. And then on Thursday we're going to dive into it becoming an empire. And so you can get that entire series, Ancient Rome from Republic to Empire, for a pledge of $75. We also have an entire collection of about 10 interviews, which includes this three-hour special on the ancient Roman world. And you can get that also on CD for a pledge of $125. It includes, again, this entire three-hour special that we're doing this week. It includes our show that we did on Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, sort of the two early revolutionaries in Rome that we're going to talk about tomorrow. Kyle Harper on climate change, natural disasters, and disease, and how they all contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire. Bart Ehrman on the Roman Empire becoming a Christian empire. And then Catherine Nixie on how the rise of Christianity brought upon the destruction of the ancient world. Also, our conversation with Arthur Eckstein on Roman politics in the ancient world and politics today, how they compare and contrast. So you can get all of those for a pledge of $125. And then finally, for a pledge of $180 on a USB drive, you can get our entire set of interviews on the ancient world. It is the Ancient History Pack, more than 30 interviews, and it ranges. You get all the stuff about Rome, all the stuff we've done about Greece. You also get Reza Zarghami on ancient Persia, Jonathan Lyons on the scientific advancements of the Islamic caliphates, Gerard Russell on the pre-Christian Islamic Middle Eastern world, Edmund Garib on the history of ancient sites that have been destroyed by ISIS, and a whole lot more. Reza Aslan on the politics of Jesus Christ. So that's more than 30 interviews, and that's going to be about it's going to be about 20 hours in length. You get that for a pledge of $180. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. That's if you're listening to KPFA in Northern California. And if you're listening to Southern California, if you're listening to KPFK in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. And online at kpfk.org or kpfa.org, whichever radio station you are listening to. Finally, and quickly, this very hour, we've had a very large donation come in from Maurice in Redwood City, who is saying that if we are able to raise $2,000 this hour, Maurice is going to throw in $2,000, and that's $4,000 for the hour. So this is a big opportunity. One of our very own listeners, he says, thanks, Mitch. I love the show, and thank you, Maurice. Thank you for your incredible generosity. But, of course, it's now dependent on us being able to raise an additional $2,000 before the top of the hour. So here we go. The phone number again, if you're listening to KPFA and you want to help us make this a success, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or online at kpfa.org, and in Southern California, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. We now return to our conversation with Edward Watts about the nature of the ancient Roman Republic. Let's talk about the structures of a republic. And if we talk about the structures of our own republic, you just look at the checks and balances that we find in the United States Constitution. We have a White House, which we call the executive branch. We have Congress, which is the legislative branch. And then we have the judicial branch that is headed by the Supreme Court. And as we know, those all serve as a check and balance upon one another, at least when they are operating in a good way. And the Roman Republic, and I think there are more than the four I have listed here, but the ones that I have listed here are the consuls, which I guess in some ways is like a president, but not exactly. The tribunes, which is someone who is supposed to represent the people. In fact, I even think the word tribune means protector of the people. So when you see a newspaper call itself a tribune, that's sort of the root word there. Consilium plebis. And then, of course, most people have heard about the Roman Senate. But there are more than just those four, right?
In Rome, I think if you were to talk about the branches of government, you would talk about the assemblies. So the Consilium Plebis is an assembly of only plebeians. There is a popular assembly. There's also a very old assembly that's based on more or less the amount of wealth that people have as allocated to or as divided based on the type of equipment they could provide in military campaigns. And that's largely outdated by the third century, though it's still in use. The Senate is an assembly made up of ex-magistrates. And so they're not directly elected. They are, in a sense, people who used to hold power in the state. And so that would be, in a sense, the legislative aspects of the Roman Republic. And then you have the office holders. And those would be more or less people who propose laws to the legislative assemblies, but also people who execute those laws. And so the consuls are the people, they're the supreme magistrates in the Roman state, and they're the people who execute those laws. The judicial system in Rome is different than what you have in the United States, because prosecutions were initiated by individuals. And our judicial system as an independent branch of government actually provides a much more effective check on misconduct than what the Romans had. And so in that sense, it's an improvement. But if you look at the consuls and other offices in Rome, I think one could argue that the executive offices in Rome probably are an improvement over what we have, at least in terms of generating consensus and preventing the usurpation of power by an individual. Because every magistracy in the Roman Republic is a paired magistracy, which means there's at least two people who hold that position as well, and they can effectively veto. They can effectively veto the actions taken by each other, and so there are two consuls, and they do serve in a way the same purpose as a president. In a fashion, but they can counteract each other so that neither one of them can do something like usurp power for himself. His colleague can immediately do things to block that if he were to try that. And so in that sense, I think the principle in the executive branch, if we were to call it that, for the Roman Republic, it actually provides much stronger checks on overreach and assertion or usurpation of power than we have in our system.
Yeah, it sounds quite foreign for us today to say have two presidents, but it would actually, as you say, it forces them to find compromise between each other. Could you have two consuls who are just on the same page on most things politically, or do you find that they usually differed and kind of came from different positions?
There are moments where you do get people who are basically governing as a team, but usually the idea and usually the way that these things would play out is you would have a consular election, and if it became clear that one candidate was likely to win, and this was a candidate who was in some ways disquieting or concerning to other people, you might have the other candidates kind of band together to try to block him. And this happened when Cicero was running for the consulship. There were two other people running, and they created an alliance to try to stop Cicero from becoming consul, and it didn't work. In other cases, you might have a clear idea that one other person should be in as the other consul when someone has been elected. And so when Julius Caesar was elected consul for the year 59, the senator Cato, who really very strongly opposed Julius Caesar, ensured that his son-in-law Bibulus was also put in as consul with the hope that Bibulus could block Julius Caesar and more or less neuter any actions that Julius Caesar would take that Cato didn't feel good about. In the end, neither one of those arrangements worked. Cicero was elected consul, and Julius Caesar managed to just kind of run over Bibulus. But you do see these actions to try to make the checks within that system work more effectively, if there is someone who is running for consul that you're concerned about.
The tribunes are interesting. And again, here, actually, unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore, but we used to have the Oakland Tribune newspaper. You have the Chicago Tribune newspaper. This word tribune comes from the Roman Republic. This was a position that was supposed to be considered the protectorate of the people, somebody who represented the actual people themselves. We would get this position of tribune as part of the Roman Republic because of the struggles from what was considered, what you talked about earlier, conflict of the orders.
Yeah, and this is one of the very earliest parts of the conflict of the order was the creation of the tribune. When the Republic was set up and it was dominated by patricians, it very quickly became clear to plebeians that that was a tremendous power imbalance and also something that wasn't particularly sustainable in the long term. And so in the first outbreak, really, of political turmoil following the creation of the Republic, plebeians walked out, more or less walked out of the city of Rome and created this magistracy to protect the interests of plebeians. And I think it's important to understand that the people doing this must have been wealthy plebeians and they must have been important plebeians. And they did this to protect their own interests. But the tribune was given the power to literally stand between any patrician and any plebeian who is being mistreated by that patrician. And to make sure that they were able to perform this duty, they were given something called sacrosanctity, which meant, in essence, you would be struck down if you did violence to a tribune. And this is something that more or less stands unchallenged for almost 400 years. So there isn't violence against a tribune for almost 400 years after this institution is created. But the important element of the tribunate was these were the individuals who quite literally stood forward and protected plebeians against any possible overreach by patricians running the Republic. And over time, that idea of physically intervening to prevent mistreatment expands into a kind of legislative mandate so that if one did expect some sort of social reform or economic reform that would benefit the regular people, it was much more likely to come from a tribune. Because they understood their mandate over time to have expanded into something where they protected not just the physical bodies of plebeians who were threatened by patricians, but also the interests of plebeians, both individual and collective. And so when the Republic, as the Republic evolves, the tribunes become these legislative protectors of the interests of the common people. But they, of course, also had to work within this consensus-building framework. And what the Republic comes to realize is this is a very effective tool for generating discussions that might lead to consensus policies that can fix social problems and political problems, including political inequality and economic inequality. And for much of the Republic, that process does move deliberately, and it does result in consensus and compromise around solutions that benefit all Romans. And so overall, what you see with the tribunate is an office that starts as something that has a relatively limited remit, but becomes very, very important for the functioning and the dynamic evolution of the republic over time.
Edward Watts is our guest. He is the author of the book, Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. Coming up, we dive into how major wars for Rome on the scale of world wars today would fundamentally change the Republic, and particularly talking about the three Punic Wars. My friends, a quick fundraising update in this hour. Maurice, our fellow listener, in the same very hour, has put up $2,000 as a challenge, which means if we can raise ourselves $2,000, that will be $4,000 for the hour. That means we make our goal, and that means our attempt to do something different in this fund drive by staying with topics for an entire week in order to really dive into them and try to learn from them and examine them and you know, going against the trend of doing everything in a soundbite, but trying to take time to really think and learn about stuff rather than what we usually see in broadcast media. We need to make our goals to make that successful, and this would be a great way for that to happen. I'm asking you for a contribution of what you can afford according to your own means, according to what you think we are deserving of, and what you will feel good about knowing that you did your part in this civic tradition of public broadcasting. For listeners in the San Francisco Bay Area, that phone number is on KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And for listeners in Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, and online at kpfk.org. We now return to the program. Edward Watts, this is the Roman Republic that we would have going into sort of the next big story, real important period of time that would last about 120 years or so. And that's what's known as the Punic Wars, I guess, roughly from 264 BC to 146 BC. The Punic Wars is three wars over that period of time against Carthage, which you'd find in North Africa, sort of modern day Lebanon today. And Carthage is really the power of the Mediterranean world at this time as we are watching the ascent of this Roman Republic.
Yeah, in the same way, if you're thinking of Greek history, you're thinking of Athens versus Sparta. If you're thinking of Roman history in this central central part of the Roman Republic, you're thinking about Rome versus Carthage. And the relationship between Rome and Carthage was both very long-standing. One of the first documents we have talking about the Roman Republic is a treaty that Carthage signs, recognizing it as the legitimate government in Rome. It goes all the way back to 509. And what you see is Rome and Carthage actually cooperate with each other with some regularity. When Pyrrhus of Epirus invades southern Italy, Carthage actually is a Roman ally in that conflict. And so these are two cities that are really powerful cities that have different kinds of ways of exercising that power. Rome has the most powerful army in the central Mediterranean. And Carthage has the most powerful navy in the central Mediterranean. And for the most part, that means that their interests don't collide because they're not interested in exerting power over similar things. But after the victory over Pyrrhus of Epirus, Rome has effectively come to control all of the Italian peninsula. And it begins looking to expand into some of the islands in the central Mediterranean, most importantly, Sicily. And this brings it eventually into conflict with Carthage. And so the First Punic War is a war in which a naval power that has the ability to fight on land but doesn't like to do it particularly, and a land power that doesn't really have the ability to fight on sea, somehow come into a conflict with each other over the islands in the central Mediterranean. And ultimately, Rome has a higher tolerance for the expense and cost of that war than Carthage does. And Rome ends up winning the First Punic War. But what follows the First Punic War is something that is particularly disreputable. And even Romans can't actually even come up with an explanation for why Rome behaved as it did. Because Rome gets control of Sicily after the First Punic War. And then the islands of Sardinia and Corsica, which Carthage retained control over, rebel. And they appeal to Rome. And Rome then redeclares war on Carthage, simply so that it can take these two islands. And Carthage is not in a position to defend itself against Rome, and Rome steals these two islands from Carthage. One of the people who was particularly aggrieved at Roman behavior in this context is, well, a young man named Hannibal. And as Hannibal comes through the ranks, he eventually gets control over Carthaginian forces in Spain. It becomes very clear, and our sources generally agree, that Hannibal hated the Romans. He found them to be absolutely disreputable, dishonorable, and intolerable. And Hannibal more or less goads Rome into declaring war against Carthage and then shocks Rome by invading Italy. And Hannibal's goal was really to provoke Rome into fighting pitched battles against him and hopefully pulling some of Rome's support in Italy away from it by showing that Rome couldn't defeat him. And Rome falls into this trap three times. And the most serious defeat was in central Italy, in an area called Cannae, where Rome overall loses almost 100,000 people. What the Republic then has to decide to do is, how do you respond to this situation? And the remarkable thing about it is the Republic reaches a consensus that it will do the ancient equivalent of mounting a total war against Hannibal. And that means that industrial activity will go towards making weapons. It means that the food supply to the city of Rome is going to be not particularly secure. It means that nearly every military age man will now serve in the army. It means that you will go from having a few legions to maybe 25 legions. It means that you will be fighting in Greece. It means you'll be fighting in Libya. It means you'll be fighting in Tunisia. It means you'll be fighting in Spain.
I mean, this sounds like a world war.
You'll be doing this for as long as it takes.
Yeah, it sounds like a world war.
It is the equivalent of, say, what the Soviet Union does in World War II. It is the entire society rearranges itself to fight Hannibal. And there is a consensus to do this and to accept whatever costs the society will have to bear. And that's something that a republic can do that most societies cannot. And to Rome's great credit, it does this for 15 years until Hannibal is finally defeated.
I was riveted in reading this part in your book, Mortal Republic, because having a war like this, and I think this is part of the lesson, inevitably changes the Republic. And you even have one line, and it's just one line that's actually in between parentheses, that you compared it to the United States post-World War II.
Yeah.
How did the Punic Wars change the nature of the Roman Republic?
The victory over Carthage, it helps generate an economic revolution that creates tremendous and very rapidly advancing wealth inequality in Rome. And so the weird legacy of the Second Punic War is Roman society that is simultaneously both more wealthy and also in some ways less stable.
And more unequal?
Absolutely. And I think the important thing for us to understand is that there is in absolute terms, economic inequality in that society. But there's also a sense of unequal opportunity. And this is, I think, something that's important for us to understand, because it's something I think we're confronting now as well. In the aftermath of the Second Punic War, Hannibal had killed so many Italians and had devastated so much Italian land that there was a lot of space and opportunity for people in Rome to basically rebuild their society. And so if we look at the demographics of Italy after the Punic Wars, what we tend to see is there's a baby boom that rapidly replenishes the Italian population. But for two generations, there's ample land and a lot of jobs and a lot of well-paying jobs for all of those new Romans and all of those new Italians to feel like they're doing better than their parents, to feel like they're more prosperous, and to feel like there are opportunities that they are realizing. But right about the time that the Roman financial sector starts taking off and these examples of really extravagant and ostentatious displays of wealth start coming in, that opportunity for regular Romans and regular Italians starts to dry up. And by the 150s, you have stories on the one hand of large villas by the seaside and banquets where guests are eating ostrich and flamingo tongues as delicacies, and parties where people are dissolving pearls in vinegar so that they can drink their wealth away. This is occurring at the same time that regular Italians and regular Romans are seeing their economic prospects stagnate, or in some cases even get worse than what their parents faced. And it's important to understand they're not starving. This isn't a widespread onset of poverty, but it's relative poverty, and it's a relative lack of opportunity. And it's occurring at the same time that the wealthy Romans are getting fabulously wealthy and displaying that wealth in ways that are quite conspicuous, and it's quite difficult to take if you feel like you don't have the same opportunities that, say, your father had or your grandfather had.
Edward J. Watts is a professor of history at UC San Diego and author of the book Mortal Republic, How Rome Fell into Tyranny. He joins us again tomorrow for a conversation of how this inequality that would come to Rome would put great stresses upon the Republic itself, eventually over the next 130 years or so, ripping it apart, eventually becoming an empire. This is Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. My friends, a fundraising update towards that $2,000 that our friend Maurice has put up this hour, and this one of our fellow listeners challenging us to raise an additional $2,000. We are $1,100 towards that $2,000 challenge with 4.5 minutes to go. Only 4.5 minutes, because I am dedicating myself in this drive to bringing you as much of the content as possible as we try to do something special, I hope, for this fund drive by diving into particular topics for an entire week and really get into it and take time and be able to breathe and take up space with these things in order to learn more about them. I can only do it if we make it a success by making our goal $900 away. The phone number is, if you're listening in the San Francisco Bay Area or Northern California or to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, and online at kpfa.org. And if you're listening in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. 3.5 minutes. We are now $800 towards that challenge. We could do it. That's 8 people right now pledging $100, 4 people pledging $200, a single person pledging $800, or a whole lot more folks pledging at the $25 rate. Again, for KPFA in Northern California, the phone number is, and your donation does go to your radio station, so the phone number for KPFA, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org. In Southern California, to KPFK, that phone number is 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. 5735 and online at kpfk.org. Again, we are trying to do something different this time. We're trying to do something new that we'd like to continue to do, and that's really sit down with some historians, as I'm about to do here in 2 minutes with Eric Foner, sort of preeminent historian in the Civil War era, as we could take 3 hours to talk about the 1850s to the 1890s and how it created really the modern country that we know today. That's what we are seeking, especially historians who have been sort of towards the latter end of their career, to really dive into their life work and why it matters, because we want to do something, and we believe during the times that we come to you asking for your support of this great public broadcaster that we do something special. And that's our goal here on out. But I'm going to need your help if we are going to make it happen. So again, Northern California, KPFA, the phone number is 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that phone number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735. Online at kpfk.org. Friends, we are a minute away. We are $500 there, $500 till we get to that challenge. Five individuals at $100 each, 10 at $50 in Northern California for KPFA. I'm basically out of time, but we could still make it. That number, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. Online at kpfa.org. And in Southern California, that number is 818-985-5735. 818-985-5735, or online at kpfk.org. There are thank you gifts if you're interested. You could talk to our phone room volunteers about that. But what I'm really asking you to do is to support this effort that we are starting today and continuing on with this week. So again, for KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. And for KPFK, 818-985-5735. I believe we're going to make the challenge, but I'll have to let you know for sure tomorrow.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Coming up next,
TUC Radio.
Corporations and Propaganda, Managing Public Opinion, by Alex Carey. A quote is haunting the writings of notables such as Noam Chomsky, Ed Herman, and John Stauber. It describes the essence of today's unprecedented power of the media to define what people think, know, and fear. The quote sums up a most important aspect of U.S. history, it says. The 20th century is marked by three developments of great historic importance: the growth of democracy via the expansion of the franchise, the growth of corporations, and the growth of propaganda as a means of protecting corporate power against democracy. Alex Carey, who wrote this, is no longer alive. The Australian sociologist and psychologist left behind a set of manuscripts that traced the history of propaganda in the U.S. from World War I to the Reagan era. When Noam Chomsky dedicated his book, Manufacturing Consent, to his memory, he wrote that Alex Carey would have written the definitive history of propaganda had he lived to complete his work. Today, you will hear from his original 60-page manuscript that received such praise. Even Thomas Jefferson predicted that corporate power could undermine freedom and democracy. Those who feel today that democracy has failed ought to consider Alex Carey's well-documented report of the most intense and most expensive sales campaign that corporations have ever undertaken. And this three-quarter century effort of social engineering was not for a product, but for the unfettered rights and the power of industry and the so-called free market system that has now culminated in the global trading system and the WTO. Democracy did not fall, Carey says, but it was dismantled, and it is surely in crisis today. Carey says that the U.S. people are the most brainwashed of any other major industrial power. It happened slowly, over decades, almost unnoticed, and now prevents us from exercising the rights that are duly ours. Since no police or military power could force us to submit, a media apparatus was built to convince us to give up many of our rights, dreams, and aspirations. And Alex Carey says that those who now wield the power taken from us are large corporations. Here's the first half of a two-part program on the history of propaganda in the U.S. Alex Carey on managing public opinion. The reader is Ed Markman.
Corporations had two major objectives as they developed propaganda as a tool of managing public opinion: to identify the free enterprise system with every cherished value, and to identify unions with interventionist governments, tyranny, oppression, and subversion. He lists the techniques to achieve these results. They're all called by familiar names: public relations, corporate communications, and economic education. In order to defend business interests against popular governments and against labor unions, a complex of institutions has been created. Their expressed purpose is to monitor public opinion and manage it within the ideological confines acceptable to American business. For 50 years, U.S. businesses, alone in the world, made great progress toward the ideal of propaganda, a managed democracy. Since 1970, businesses in other countries have begun to adopt that model. This transfer carries a profound threat to the democratic institutions and the union movement in these countries. The history of the last 80 years shows that such a victory was not entirely simple and easy for the corporations. Alex Carey identifies three phases, each of which shows strong advances of the union and democratic movements in the U.S., and each ending with propaganda assaults that ended these phases. For the first period, spanning World War I, Carey describes the union gains during the war and the defeat of the labor movement in that brief but violent period of anti-leftism ending in the Palmer Raids of the early 1920s. Phase 2, from 1932 till 1950, spans the Depression, World War II, and the beginning of the second campaign against the left under McCarthy. Again, union gains during World War II are rolled back, and new restrictive labor laws are enacted to limit the gains made by labor during the 30s. In the light of that history, the emergence of the neoconservative movements as a strong political power and Ronald Reagan's victory appears as the culmination of more than half a century of political work. Carey talks about that phase in the third part of his work and states that the only thing that is new about the current new right, which sets the political agenda in the U.S., is the unprecedented output and scale of funding of business-sponsored propaganda. Propaganda in democracies is usually not recognized as that. Propaganda is supposedly a tool only in totalitarian regimes. Now, Carey argues, why would only a totalitarian government have to rely on propaganda to convince its citizens of particular policies, although these citizens have no power to affect these policies? Common sense would suggest that propaganda is much more needed in democratic societies, where citizens have the right, and in theory, the power, to change the policies of their governments. But as Alex Carey says, common sense has already become a victim of propaganda. It is very striking that Noam Chomsky develops a very similar argument.
Although we call our era the Age of Orwell, the fact is that Orwell was a latecomer on the scene. In the 1920s, a sophisticated American public relations industry was already developing and writing about the tools Orwell described. In 1921, the famous American journalist Walter Lippmann said that the art of democracy requires what he called the manufacture of consent, what the public relations industry calls the engineering of consent. The idea was that in a state in which the government can't control the people by force, it had better control what they think.
That was a quote by MIT professor of linguistics and political scientist Noam Chomsky. And now allow me to take you back in time to the beginning of the century, the first stage of engineered consent, the beginnings of corporate propaganda. Alex Carey, Democracy and Propaganda, the First Popular Challenge, from the beginning till 1920. Between 1880 and 1920, the popular vote in the United States and the United Kingdom was extended from around 10 to 15% of the population to 40 or 50%. Leading researchers warned as early as 1909 of the likely consequences of this development.
Popular election may work fairly well as long as those questions are not raised, which cause the holders of wealth and power to make full use of their resources. But should wealth and power be challenged, there is so much skill to be bought, and the art of using skill for the production of emotion and opinion has so advanced that the whole condition of political contests would be changed for the future.
4 years later, in 1913, a committee of the U.S. Congress was established to investigate the mass dissemination of propaganda by the National Association of Manufacturers, hereafter called the NAM, the leading business organization of the time, for the purpose of influencing legislation by influencing public opinion. The committee appears to have been no little awed by the apparent ambitions of the NAM for meeting the challenge to its interest from popular democracy by controlling public opinion. Its investigations revealed, the committee reported, that the aspirations of the NAM were so vast and far-reaching as to excite at once admiration and fear. Admiration for the genius which conceived them, and fear for the effects which the accomplishment of all these ambitions might have in a government such as ours. The committee's report coincided with the beginning of World War I, during which the Allied governments expended unprecedented resources on the development and dissemination of propaganda to create patriotism and hatred. Propaganda became a science and a profession. A campaign launched by President Wilson on America's entry into the war in 1917 filled every home, workplace, and leisure activity of the society with its messages. The campaign produced within 6 months so intense an anti-German hysteria as to permanently impress American business, and Adolf Hitler among others, with the potential of large-scale propaganda to control public opinion. Walter Lippmann, the eminent journalist, and Edward Bernays, a nephew of Sigmund Freud, served with Wilson's propaganda organization. Bernays led the transfer of wartime propaganda skills to businesses' peacetime problems of coping with democracy. When the war ended, Bernays later wrote, businesses realized that the great public could now be harnessed to their cause, as it had been harnessed during the war to the national cause, and the same methods would do the job. This wartime governmental propaganda organization, I might add, was called the U.S. Committee on Public Information, and was the first propaganda institution in this country, and Edward Bernays was the only professional public relations man in this office. It seems ironic in retrospect that his uncle, Sigmund Freud, made major discoveries about the subconscious, while the nephew goes on to place these discoveries in the use of government and business. Bernays remembers that some media actually refused to accept his publicity stunts as news. There was at that time a certain integrity with some media who insisted that so-called manufactured events were not news and should not be reported. When the war ended, there was a confrontation between American business and labor. Business was determined to roll back the limited union gains made under wartime conditions. The confrontation culminated in the Great Steel Strike of 1919. The central issue of the strike was, in the words of Samuel Gompers, the right of wage owners to bargain collectively. At the outset, public opinion favored the strikers, who worked an 84-hour week under notoriously bad conditions. 5 days after the strike began, the Steel Corporation launched a campaign of full-page advertisements which urged the strikers to return to work, denounced their leaders as trying to establish the red rule of anarchy and Bolshevism, the strike as un-American, and even suggested that the Huns had a hand in fomenting the strike. The strike was monitored by a remarkable body called the Interchurch World Movement, IWM, which was comprised of 26 Protestant churches. The IWM produced a two-volume report which concluded that the strike was defeated by the strike-breaking methods of the steel companies and their effective mobilization of public opinion against the strikers through the charges of radicalism, Bolshevism, and the closed shop, none of which were justified by the facts, and through the hostility of the press giving biased and colored news. Historian Robert Murray sums up the consequences.
When the strike ended in January 1920, the men had gained not a single concession. 20 lives had been sacrificed and $112 million lost in wages. Backed by a favorable public opinion which was based on an exaggerated fear of Bolshevism, this corporation proved that not even 350,000 strikers could prevail against it.
The Secretary of Labor of the period, Lewis Post, has described how, supported by corporate interest, the propaganda assault on public opinion was widened and extended until it produced an anti-red hysteria about an invented plan by workers and their leaders to overthrow the government. A McCarthyist period ensued from 1919 to 1921, more severe, though of shorter duration, than the McCarthy period after World War II.
And here then, as final speaker on today's program, is Warren G. Harding, delivering in 1920 a presidential campaign address titled Liberty Under the Law.
It would be the blindness of folly to ignore the activities in our own country which are aimed to destroy our economic system and to commit us to the colossal tragedy which has both destroyed all freedom and made Russia impotent. He who threatens destruction of the government by force or flaunts his contempt for lawful authority ceases to be a loyal citizen and forfeits his right to the freedom of the Republic.
Meantime, in Europe, where a similar progressive period was not cut off by a propaganda assault on public opinion, a different result ensued. Charles Forsay observes that after World War I in Great Britain and elsewhere, liberal parties gave way to labor or social democratic groups. In the United States, by contrast, politics moved in the opposite direction, and the socialists during the 20s virtually disappeared while liberals were reduced to an ineffective few. During the 1920s, American intellectuals, reflecting on wartime and post-war experience, believed that democracy had reached a crisis. The manufacture of consent was supposed to have died out with the appearance of democracy. Walter Lippmann wrote in 1922, but it has not died out. It has, in fact, improved enormously in technique. Under the impact of propaganda, he concluded, it is no longer possible to believe in the original dogma of democracy, i.e., that it necessarily reflects the popular will in any significant way. Reviewing the experience of World War I, Harold Lasswell, the leading American student of propaganda for the next 50 years, reached similar conclusions in 1927.
With the decline of the authority of crown, church, and social class, and the rise of egalitarianism generally, propaganda had become the principal method of social control. If the mass will be free of chains of iron, It must accept chains of silver. If it will not love, honor, and obey, it must not expect to escape seduction.
Depression and Propaganda, the Second Popular Challenge, Chapter 2 of Managing Public Opinion by Alex Carey. Throughout the 1920s, American business had no more problems with democracy or trade unions. However, the onset of the Great Depression changed that circumstance dramatically. With tens of millions jobless and hungry, business was initially stunned by the intensity of public hostility. For the first time, American business's ideological hegemony over American society was temporarily broken. It became politically and morally respectable to advocate government ownership, socialism, and even communism as alternatives to the free enterprise system, a development which provided a multitude of victims for the second McCarthy period of the 1950s. By 1934, American business, led by the NAM, had organized itself for a massive campaign to recapture public opinion. Public policies in our democracy are eventually a reflection of public opinion, the NAM warned its members. So public opinion must be reshaped if we are to avoid disaster. A nationwide assault on public opinion was rapidly coordinated. By 1935, the president of the NAM could report to a meeting of business leaders, "You will note especially that this is not a hit-or-miss program. It is skillfully integrated so as to gradually blanket every media. And then it pounds its message home with relentless determination." But while the Depression lasted, even the resources of business and its Red Scare tactics could not rapidly prevail. As late as 1938, the NAM's board of directors, in a curiously Marxist formulation, still found the hazard facing industrialists lies in the newly realized political power of the masses. Unless their thinking is directed, it warned, we are definitely headed for adversity. The following year, the La Follette Committee, a committee of the U.S. Senate, which had been established to investigate violations of the rights of labor, incidentally exposed the extraordinary scale of business's assault on public opinion. Of the National Association of Manufacturers in particular, the Congressional Committee reported in 1939,
NAM blanketed the country with propaganda which in technique has relied upon indirection of meaning and in presentation on secrecy and deception. Radio speeches, public meetings, news, cartoons, editorials, advertising, motion pictures, and many other artifices of propaganda have not, in most instances, disclosed to the public their origin within the association.
In the same year, Professor Laswell, referring to the tremendous campaign that had been conducted by business, concluded that, for better or for worse, the future of business is bound up with propaganda. Meantime, public relations techniques for combating unions had also made progress. Until the passage of the Wagner Act in 1935, which required managements to bargain with representatives of labor, unions had few rights, and attempts to organize workers were commonly met with violence and intimidation. After the Wagner Act, the industrialists sought, in the words of the La Follette Committee, a new alignment of forces. That is, they sought through propaganda and other means to arouse and organize the public at large to do to labor on industry's behalf what the individual employer himself could no longer do legally. This tactic, it was reported at the time, envisages a public opinion aroused to the point where it will tolerate the often outrageous use of force by police or vigilantes to break a strike. The Remington Rand Corporation is credited with having perfected this tactic, which then became known as the Mohawk Valley Formula. The NAM distributed details of the formula to all members in a special release in July 1936. In essence, the formula consists in employer mobilization of the public in a labor dispute. Some excerpts from an account of its use will indicate its more significant features. These features foreshadow the general subordination of industrial relations to public relations that developed in the decades after World War II. The dispute was between the CIO and the Bethlehem plant at Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which refused to recognize the Steel Union.
Bethlehem Steel was aided in the dispute by the national publicity of the Iron and Steel Institute and the National Association of Manufacturers. Radio programs, outdoor advertising, news services, films, and speakers bureaus deluged the country with anti-CIO propaganda. A full-page advertisement in 375 papers at the outset of the CIO Steel campaign had cost as much as $314,000.
Wake Up America. The American Economic Foundation presents the 90th broadcast of the Wake Up America Radio Forum, the court of open argument where the problems of the nation are analyzed and the voice of the people may be heard. This discussion will center around the future of free competitive enterprise in America. The speakers are the Honorable T.V. Smith, former congressman at large, lecturer and educator in the field of philosophy, and Dr. Alfred P. Hockey.
During the strike, a National Citizens Committee, which purported to be a spontaneous expression of community sentiment, was launched by local businessmen. This artificially created Citizens Committee engaged an advertising agency and a public relations council. More than $62,000 in donations was collected. The committee twice broadcast its messages over a national network. Two full-page advertisements appeared in 30 newspapers in 13 states at a cost of $64,000. After the strike was broken, a labor bulletin of the NAM epitomized the rationale of the Mohawk Valley formula.
If there ever was a strike that was broken by public opinion and the determination of employees to work, it was the one at Johnstown in 1937.
That doesn't mean, however, that public opinion was the only method of strike breaking in the 30s. Auerbach, in Labor and Liberty, reports that between 1933 and 1937, Republic Steel, United States Steel, Bethlehem Steel, and Youngstown Steel and Tube each purchased more gas equipment than did any law enforcement agency in the United States. Republic, with 52,000 employees, purchased more than 10 times as many gas guns and more than 26 times as many gas shells and projectiles as did the Chicago Police Department, which was responsible for the safety of 3.3 million persons. During the same period, explains Alex Carey, Republic Steel hired the PR firm of Hill and Knowlton to look after its reputation while employing an extensive espionage network and locking workers out of plants. In many cases, such public relations served simply as a protective screen for the violence used by corporations. But such public relations, seen in the context of labor history, represents also a real change in corporate policies. Strikes are no longer broken or violently suppressed, testifies an executive before the La Follette Committee. The new way to win or combat a strike is by organizing community sentiment. This is the beginning of a new era. After World War II, the emphasis has shifted almost entirely to public relations. Before World War II, business had campaigned against the Roosevelt administration and accused it of carrying the country towards communism or even fascism. During the war, business had to curb its campaign. However, in the last year of the war, American business, and the NAM in particular, geared up as it had after World War I to beat back both government intervention and the growing power of unions.
That was the first half of a one-hour program on corporations and propaganda by the late Alex Carey. Alex Carey was an Australian sociologist and psychologist. The reading was from a manuscript he left behind at his death in 1988. The principal reader was Ed Markman. The music is by Chaz Smith. Sound clips are from the audio collection of San Francisco State University. The original program was produced in 1988 with help from the staff at KPFA Radio in Berkeley by me, Mariah Glidden. It had a huge impact when it first aired, and I decided to present it again at this time because it answers so many questions about the media, democracy, and corporate power in our age of war and globalization. Next week, you will hear what role the industry and Chamber of Commerce played in starting the era of McCarthy and the Un-American Activities Committee. A collection of essays by Alex Carey with a foreword by Noam Chomsky, has since been published posthumously under the title Taking the Risk Out of Democracy. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. This program was produced off the grid with solar power. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
How can you describe this as a dictatorial repressive government when Guaido, who proclaimed himself a president when he wasn't, has called for the army to remove the government, the democratically elected president, has called for military intervention by a foreign power, and then on Tuesday he carried out a coup against an attempted coup with military force. He's still free.
That's the voice of Jorge Martí. In this week's show, we continue our discussion with Jorge Martí, Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. We talk about this week's latest coup attempt and the future of Venezuela and workers around the world, so stay tuned.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson. I'm privileged this morning to be joined by Jorge Martí. He is the Secretariat of Hands Off Venezuela. Welcome to our show, Jorge.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Thank you. Now, this past week has been a momentous week for the people of Venezuela. Can you paint a picture of what the situation is like in Venezuela at this moment?
Yes. What happened on Tuesday, the 30th of April, was that Guaido, the opposition leader, attempted a military coup. He issued a video early in the morning, just before 6 in the morning, with some, where he was flanked by some soldiers, about maybe 20, 30, 40 soldiers, And he was also accompanied by Leopoldo López, who is a Venezuelan opposition leader who was arrested after the 2014 Guarimba rioting by the opposition, and he was charged with destruction of property, incitement to violence, and so on. And he was under house arrest. So apparently he was released by the troops that were guarding him in his house, and some of these troops joined Guaido. And in this video, early in the morning video on Tuesday, April the 30th, he made an appeal. Well, he basically said that all military units in the country were with him and that they were going to remove the Maduro and, in his words, restore constitutional order. But very soon it appeared, it became clear that this coup was going nowhere, and half of the things he had said were not true. First of all, he was not inside the La Carlota military airbase, as he had claimed. He was outside of the base. He did not have any command of troops, and by mid-morning it became clear that all of the military officers and all of the military bases in the country were still loyal to the democratically elected President Maduro. And by the end of the day, his attempted coup had completely collapsed. Some of the soldiers that were with him said that they'd been taken there under false pretenses, and they returned to the military bases and left, abandoned the coup. Some others sought asylum in the Brazilian embassy, and Leopoldo López, his main co-conspirator, went into hiding into the Chilean embassy first and then the Spanish embassy. So basically what we saw on Tuesday was a very badly prepared and carried out coup, but also a very dangerous one, because it could have very easily led to armed clashes in the capital, which did not happen. And basically, obviously, the United States gave full support to the coup as the coup was developing. Bolton, Mike Pompeo, and others said that this was the restoration of democracy, that they fully supported this. There was also during the day, there was a big Chavista demonstration outside the Miraflores Palace. President Maduro had called on the people to come and defend the Miraflores Palace. There were thousands of people there. By the end of the day, the coup had collapsed. But the day after, which was May Day yesterday, there were also opposition demonstrations in different parts of the country. There was also a Chavista demonstration. And Guaido was still free. And he participated and addressed the opposition demonstration in Caracas. So that's basically what's happened this week, which is obviously part of what's been happening since January, when Guaido proclaimed himself to be the president with the full backing of the United States and other right-wing governments. And this is basically all part of this attempt by Washington, by the Trump administration, to implement regime change in Venezuela and remove the President Maduro.
It would be comical if it wasn't so violent and dangerous. This is not the first time that the U.S. has tried a coup against the Bolivarian people. This time, I think the aggression has been more systematic and more devastating in terms of the economic and trade tools that are being used to squeeze and debilitate the people of Venezuela. Can we talk a little bit about the amping of the sanctions that happened on March 29th?
Yes. I mean, the sanctions on Venezuela on the part of the United States were originally introduced under the Obama administration in 2015 when he signed an executive order that declared that the situation in Venezuela was an immediate and present threat to the U.S. national security. And on the basis of that executive order, a number of sanctions have been implemented over the last 4 years. The first sanctions were so-called targeted sanctions that affected government officials and officials in the government, in the army, and so on. But then, as of August 2017, the sanctions were stepped up, and the sanctions were now preventing anyone from trading with Venezuelan bonds and debt and state debt, issuing new bonds or state debt. So basically they were trying to cut off the Venezuelan government from access to the financial markets. And then finally, as you say, in January, February this year. Then there was a massive stepping up of the sanctions, whereby the U.S. government declared a complete embargo on any oil purchases from Venezuela. We have to remember that the United States was one of the main purchasers of Venezuelan oil to the tune of between 500,000 and 700,000 barrels of oil per day. So this really hit the Venezuelan economy very badly. And also these sanctions prevent Venezuela from processing anything in the United States, including the fact that Venezuela has to, Venezuelan oil, particularly in the Orinoco Belt, is extra heavy crude oil that needs to be refined. And in order to be refined, they need a number of products, including dissolvents, naphtha, and which Venezuela used to purchase 90% from the United States. So this is now also cut off. On top of this, the U.S. also seized assets belonging to the Venezuelan oil company in the United States worth $7 billion U.S. dollars. And to all intents and purposes, they have seized all assets by Citgo, which is a subsidiary of PDVSA, in the United States, which is also very damaging. And not only this, but throughout this period, the United States has also been threatening third parties like India, Russia, number of commercial banks that were trading with Venezuela in other countries, Turkey, they've been threatening them to respect U.S. sanctions or else be faced with sanctions themselves. So basically, they're attempting to strangulate, to asphyxiate the Venezuelan economy, which is heavily dependent on oil, in the hope that this will convince either the population to rise up against Maduro or the army to move to remove him from power, something that, which hasn't happened so far. This attempted coup has been unsuccessful, and I stress that it has been unsuccessful so far. It doesn't mean that the danger is over. It doesn't mean that the United States is going to let go or ease off of the regime change attempts.
Can you talk a little bit about what this has what the impact of this has been on the population of Venezuela in terms of health, in terms of the lives that are being caused by the sanctions?
The economic crisis in Venezuela is very serious. It has knocked out about 50% of GDP since 2014. And the cause of the Venezuelan economic crisis is not sanctions, but quite clearly sanctions heavily aggravate the economic crisis and its impact on the population. For instance, if Venezuela is unable to renegotiate its debt, it means that it has to pay its debt in full or else default on its debt payments, which will further isolate it from the financial markets. This means using the scarce amount of money it has in foreign currency reserves to pay the debt instead of using this money to purchase much needed food and medical supplies, with a direct impact on the country's on the population's well-being. On top of this, if Venezuela is unable to sell oil to the United States, it then has to look for other customers, which is a complex and costly and time-consuming process, which is not solved in one day. If Venezuela cannot purchase dissolvents from the United States, then it has to look for those from other countries which are much further away, like Nigeria or others, at a bigger cost, at a higher cost. So all of this has a direct impact on the ability of the government to continue carrying out the social programs it carried out in the past, and it has led to a situation where obviously there's more scarcity of basic products, there's more scarcity of medications, and so on. There's a new study by the CEPR in the United States which calculates that about 40,000 people have died in Venezuela in the last few years, directly or indirectly as a result of the sanctions regime. So that's the real cost of these sanctions, which are designed to cause pain on the population. That's quite clear.
When we think about what we want in society, we see throughout the world voices rising against a very consolidated wealth class that continues the plundering and colonization of many places. In the case of, we focus on Venezuela, and you know, the media points at Venezuela as a place where there's injustice. But we forget soon that, you know, very much here in Canada, Indigenous people are still without potable water. We have 280 communities without potable water, where injustice is the order of the day. We see in Europe, you know, the case of the Yellow Jackets. And what this says to me is the resonance of creating a culture where insecurity and instability of the working class of people and average people is the order of the day. And I think that's perhaps why Venezuela poses such a threat to the world, is that Venezuelans were able not only to pay off their debt, but were also able to create social services and social, you know, safety networks that help people thrive. Can we talk a little bit about what is at risk if we allow this plundering, this very odious ways of systematic, you know, economic isolation of a country like Venezuela to continue?
Yeah, it's clear. It's quite clear that the Bolivarian Revolution, at its peak, managed to deliver social programs that greatly benefited the lives of millions of people in very concrete terms. For instance, Venezuela introduced free higher education for all, increasing the number of university students from 800,000 to 2.3 million, massively increased the number of people receiving old age pensions, improved the access to health care to the majority of the country's poor in a program run together with Cuban medical doctors and medical personnel. They also manage a program of house building, which has built and delivered 2 million units of social housing free of charge for those receiving them. And so Venezuela, which is a third world country, has managed to implement policies by using the resources of the country for the benefit of the majority, has managed to implement programs which put many advanced capitalist countries to shame. I mean, I'm based here in London in the UK, and over here we have a completely disastrous situation where university students have to pay tuition fees, which leave them massively in debt when they finish their studies, where the NHS, the National Health Service, is being starved of funds. Today, they just published a figure that 200 nurses have committed suicide over the last 4 years because of overwork and stress caused by cuts in healthcare and education. Millions of people have to use food banks because they can't make ends meet on a monthly basis. So Venezuela became, the Bolivarian Revolution became a very dangerous example for the capitalist world of what was possible. If Guaido comes to power, there is no doubt that all of this will be eradicated. I mean, some of the conquests of the Bolivarian Revolution have already been eroded by the economic crisis, by the sanctions regime, and so on. But some still remain. And all of this will be eliminated, will be destroyed completely if Guaido comes to power, backed by Trump. He has already published his program. It's called the Plan País, the program for the country. And it involves the privatization of all state-owned companies, the return of the land, which was distributed to the peasants, to the former landowners, which left it idle in the past, the massive program of layoffs in the public sector under the slogan of rationalization, the introduction of privatization in healthcare, in education, the opening up of the oil industry to foreign multinationals in very favorable terms, which is something that John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor, demanded a couple of months ago. It's a destruction of workers' rights. It's a program really of an all-out assault against all the gains of the Bolivarian Revolution. This will be a defeat not only for the Venezuelan working people, the workers, the poor, the peasants, but also for working people around the world. they want to make Venezuela an example that if you try to go against the policies that the United States is imposing everywhere, the policies of capitalist austerity and cuts, the opening up of to private investment, the privatization of everything that moves, then you will pay a heavy price for that. This is the reason why we need to defend the Bolivarian revolution. I would say we need to defend and expand the Bolivarian revolution.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what inspires you, because in spite of all the aggression against Venezuela, in spite of all the aggression, both economic, the military threat, the way that is being surrounded, the people continue to be strong. And in spite of all the blackouts and everything that has been thrown at them, the Venezuelan people seem to be standing strong. And I wonder if you could talk about why that is, what keeps them inspired, what can we learn from there?
Yes, I think that in Venezuela, obviously, the support for the Bolivarian revolution and the Maduro government has steadily been going down, particularly since 2014, with the economic crisis. There are many people who are disillusioned with the government, with the inability of the government to deal with the economic crisis. There are many people who are critical of the bureaucratic way in which popular initiative is being stifled by government officials and so on. But when it comes to this coup, which started in January, on January 24th, when Guaido proclaimed himself the president of Venezuela at a street rally, there are many people, even people who are critical of the government, that they are very clear that what they don't want is an imperialist intervention in their country, that they don't want Guaido to come to power, because that will be a massive disaster for everyone, for all working people. I myself am critical of some of the policies of the Maduro government, which I think has been too compromising with the opposition. It has made too many concessions to the capitalist class, which have not served for any useful purpose. And that instead of trying to make compromises or going forward on some of the legacy of Hugo Chavez, that the government should be going forward, not backwards. But nevertheless, when it comes to an imperialist intervention like this is very clearly, when it comes to an attempted coup, regime change, which is backed by imperialism, there is a very strong anti-imperialist feeling amongst the layers of the workers, the poor, and the peasants. And there have been really in the last four months, while this coup has been going on, this attempted coup, there have been mass demonstrations in Caracas, in other parts of the country, in Bolivar, in Merida, everywhere. And these have generally not been reported in the mass media outside of Venezuela because it doesn't fit their narrative. They tell you that the government has no support amongst the population, is only in power because of its repressive ways. But I'm asking myself, how can you describe this as a dictatorial repressive government when Guaido, who proclaimed himself a president when he wasn't, has called for the army to remove the government, the democratically elected president, has called for military intervention by a foreign power, and then on Tuesday, he carried out a coup against an attempted coup with military force. He's still free. Yesterday, he was addressing a May Day rally. Yesterday, Wednesday, he was addressing a May Day rally in Caracas. So how can you describe this? If anything, you can criticize Maduro for having been too lenient, for not being strong enough against the opposition, which is a coup-plotting, undemocratic opposition. And it's a credit to the Venezuelan people, the fact that they've resisted all of this, and they're still very much loyal to the Bolivarian revolution in large numbers, perhaps not as large as they were under Chavez, but still a large section of the population want to defend the legacy of President Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution because they have benefited from it, because the Bolivarian Revolution has given them a voice, has given them power, has given them a degree of decision over their own lives and their own future. And I'll just give you one example. On Tuesday, during the attempted coup, some opposition thugs in Caricuau, which is a working class area in Caracas, they ransacked and assaulted and set on fire a building which belonged to a local socialist commune. And in this building, there was a textile cooperative run by working women from the neighborhood themselves. They had a few sewing machines, and they were producing T-shirts and other things like this. They basically pooled their resources together to have a source of income. And with great effort, they managed to acquire these machines, and they were working in this building, which was also a community center. So these opposition thugs, they went in there, they stole the sewing machines, they destroyed the building, they set it on fire. And this is the reason, in this very little incident, you can see the reason why working people and the poor in Venezuela hate the opposition. The opposition is drawn mainly from the middle class and the upper class layers of society, is led by bourgeois elements in cahoots with imperialism and people, quite rightly, with a very fine class instinct. They hate them. They hate them. And however many criticisms they might have of the government or the government's lack of action or the government's policies, they definitely do not want the oligarchy to come back to power, because they know very well what that would mean in Venezuela.
Most of Latin Americans who have lived through the 80s, who have lived through the, you know, or experienced their parents' stories of invasions in Latin America, do not want, coup-imposed government. And so as we face this so-called league of, led by Canada, of the Lima group, as we face the aggression of U.S. sanctions, as we face this systematic attacks, how do we stand strong and in solidarity with the people in Venezuela? Because part of me says, well, you fight where you are, because, whether it's, standing with the Yellow Jackets if you're in France, or standing with indigenous people if you're in Canada, or standing with the poor and displaced in the U.S. who are homeless and hungry. I think that unites us in our movement, and this is how we gain strength. But how do you see us moving towards a society where plundering and pillaging is a story of the past?
Yeah, first of all, I'd like to comment that the Group of Lima is an ad hoc group of countries which has no legal standing whatsoever. This group of countries was only set up because the United States was unable to carry out its resolutions against Venezuela on the Organization of American States. And so then they set up a group which is only united, is a group of countries that they are only united by one thing, the hatred of the Bolivarian Revolution. And it includes, obviously, Canada, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, and others. But more generally, you are right. Even President Chavez at one point said the best way to help the Venezuelan revolution is to carry out the revolution in your own countries. And I think that this is very true. There is a worldwide mood of sympathy for socialism. People realize that capitalism is unable to provide for the majority, is unable to provide housing, education, healthcare, decent wages, basic human requirements, not only in third world countries, but also in advanced capitalist countries like in Britain, in Canada, in the US, and particularly amongst young people, there is a growing support for socialism. Even though the idea of what socialism is might not be completely clear, but it's clear that they don't want capitalism, and that they want a system that is able to guarantee housing, decent and free education, health care for all, and also a future for our planet, which is threatened by capitalist profits, which are destroying the environment. And this can only be achieved if there is a fundamental change in the way we run our economy. Capitalism, the private profit running everything, cannot provide for any of these things, even though in some countries in the past it was partially able to do so. But the future is socialism, really, a system where the economic means, the means of production, are collectively owned and democratically planned by the majority of the population to satisfy the needs of the many. And how do we get from capitalism to socialism? It's through a revolution. And a revolution means organizing to fight for immediate and local things, for better wages in your factory, for free healthcare, for free education, big and small struggles, everyday struggles, and more momentous movements. Until such a point, we are strong enough to take over the whole economy and overthrow this rotten capitalist regime, which threatens to put an end to life in the planet itself.
Thank you so much for being with us today. The last words are yours.
Yes, I will say that the defense of the Bolivarian Revolution is an extremely important task today. This is now the country that is more directly under threat of U.S. imperialism, with the support of other imperialist countries like Canada and the United Kingdom over here. And therefore, a victory for us here on this question is a victory for us all. And a defeat for our class in Venezuela will be a defeat for us all as well. So therefore, we need to organize, we need to spread truthful information about what's happening in Venezuela. We need to cut through the fog of lies in the mass media. But that struggle, the struggle to defend the Bolivarian Revolution, is part of the more general struggle for the socialist transformation of society. So I will advise everyone to heed the old slogan of the industrial workers of the world, the anarcho-syndicalist union from 100 years ago. They had a beautiful slogan, which was agitate, educate, and organize. So we need to be involved, we need to inform ourselves, and we need to be part of an organized movement to transform society.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you very much.
That was Jorge Martí. We reached him in England. Thank you for listening.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.